Well, welcome back, everybody. And thanks for a lively discussion this morning and very good considerations and input to us as we move ahead on our standard setting projects and consider other projects that a number of you mentioned that we should think about for our standard setting agenda. So I appreciated all the input during that session. Moving from planned standard setting to adopted standards, we mentioned a couple of times this morning the adoption of the 8 standards that we call the suite of risk assessment standards that are very foundational in their presentation. We think these standards are important. We should have improvements to audit quality, but we thought it would be a good idea to make sure the SAG understood these 8 standards and how we thought they came together and made those kind of improvements. So I think Dan, you have a couple of comments first to introduce this topic, and then Keith Wilson will lead the discussion.
Thanks, Marty. As Marty just mentioned and has come up a couple of times already today, on August 5th, the board adopted 8 new auditing standards related to the auditor's assessment of and response to risk. These standards deal with some basic foundational concepts, and their adoption was an important milestone for the board. While the risk assessment standards were being developed, they were the subject of discussion with the SAG at several of these meetings. We thought it would be worthwhile to spend a few minutes with the SAG today, giving you an overview of the final standards and how they're intended to operate. The predicate on which these standards are based is that identifying the risks of material misstatement and planning and performing the audit in a manner that properly addresses those risks is essential to affording investors reasonable assurance that the financial statements that they rely on are free of material error. Assessing and responding to risk is at the core of what auditors do. In addition, the new standards specifically emphasize the auditor's responsibility to consider the risk of fraud throughout the audit. The standards also contain new requirements intended to improve an auditor's evaluation of disclosures in financial statements. Of course, most firms' audit processes already incorporate risk-based methodologies, and the changes to audit manuals and staff training needed to implement these new standards should not be overwhelming. Along those same lines, I would note that while I think these standards will provide a better foundation for quality auditing, they should not, at least in most cases, have a significant impact on audit cost. Nonetheless, implementation is something that we need to stay on top of. One of the board's unique strengths as a standard setter is that we have the ability to inspect and see firsthand how our standards are being implemented. I hope we'll take advantage of that tool with respect to the risk assessment suite of standards. With that brief introduction of the topic, I want to turn the floor over to Keith Wilson, who's going to discuss the risk assessment standards in more detail and explain some of the enhancements that will result from their adoption. Thank you.
Thanks, Dan. As Dan mentioned, I'm going to be talking about the significant enhancements in the risk assessment standards and also at the end make some observations to try and tie in what we've accomplished with the risk assessment standards and how it would affect future standard setting. Just by way of background, I think it's important to start off by pointing out that these risk assessment standards, these suite of 8 standards, if you will, cover the entire audit process. So they start with a very early preliminary engagement procedures and go all the way through the process of evaluating audit evidence to form the opinions to be presented in the auditor's report. So they do encompass the entire audit process. An important part of what we tried to accomplish with this project was to try and address both the unique aspects of the integrated audit, and as you may recall, the AS5, the process there is very much a risk-based process. So these standards needed to coordinate and align very well with the risk assessment standards, with the standard for the audit of internal control, while at the same time providing flexibility so that they could be appropriately applied for audits of non-accelerated filers and others that are not subject to the requirement to have an internal control audit. And these standards would be effective for audits of fiscal years beginning on or after December 15, 2010, so calendar 2011 audits, if you will, subject to the approval of the SEC. These standards, after the board had approved them, they've been filed with the commission. The commission, as part of its due process, has published them for comment in the Federal Register, and I believe comments are due to the SEC on those standards on October 18th. Brian, do you have anything else you want to add?
No, I think you got it right. The comment period does close next Monday, October 18th, and certainly to the extent that anyone does have input, would encourage submission of comment letters. The staff intends to promptly analyze the comment letters that come in and make any recommendation subsequent to that to the commission with respect to consideration of final approval, but certainly encourage any comments that people have before or before the end of the comment period here on October 18th.
Thanks, Brian. These standards are intended to protect investors by enhancing auditors' assessment of and response to risk in their audits. As Dan mentioned, most auditors today employ risk-based audit methodology, so it was critical that these standards would establish requirements that would promote effective risk-based audits. And in doing that, there are three primary ingredients for that. One is establishing a process for obtaining evidence to support the auditor's risk assessments, and strengthening the requirements for linking those risk assessments to the actual audit procedures that are performed and testing controls in the financial statements, and also promoting a more comprehensive evaluation of the evidence obtained during the audit. And we'll touch on each one of these points during the course of talking about the individual standards. Another point, as was mentioned, was to try and integrate the auditor's consideration of fraud, that is, the auditor's procedures for assessing and responding to fraud risk and evaluating the results of audit procedures and taking into account indications of fraud as part of the core audit process. This was in response to some observations from inspections that auditors at time had taken an isolated mechanical approach to their consideration of fraud. And it was important to emphasize through these standards that the auditor's consideration of fraud is very much integral part of the audit process. And the other thing that Dan mentioned was these standards also do focus more attention on financial statement disclosures, and particularly in light of the increasing importance of disclosures to financial reporting. Other areas where there were enhancements, there were in the planning standard and the materiality standard, there are additional requirements related to multi-location engagements, which are particularly important considering that many of the largest corporations, in fact, all of the largest corporations are multinational corporations, multi-location corporations. So we felt like more attention was needed in our standards on these points. The standards also describe more directly the supervisory responsibilities of the engagement partner based upon, among other things, the risk of material misstatement. And the standards also enhance the requirements regarding what it means to obtain sufficient appropriate evidence to support the auditor's opinion. And we'll talk about each of these points in the context of walking through the individual standards. Auditing Standard 8 really starts at the beginning by articulating what the components of audit risk are, and then tees up, if you will, the sources of information, evidence that the auditor draws upon to, for example, identify and evaluate and assess the risks of material misstatement and to develop appropriate substantive procedures to reduce detection risk to an appropriately low level. The audit planning standard is a significant update of the auditor's responsibilities in planning. There were a couple of areas that I wanted to point out that are especially worth mentioning in this area. One, again, is the multi-location engagements. There was very little in our old interim standards about how you go through the process of selecting locations to test and how much work you would give to the in those locations that are selected for testing. This standard aligns with AS5, but more importantly, has a much more extensive discussion of what the auditor's responsibilities are for looking at the risks associated with various locations determining the amount of work that needs to be tailored to address the risks in the individual locations. Another area that was particularly important and an area that we think is improvement is in the area of using or considering in the planning process whether it's necessary to use persons with specialized skill or knowledge. And the idea there is the auditor is supposed to make a determination in planning whether they need a person or specialized skill or knowledge to effectively conduct the audit. The old interim standards, this consideration was narrowed to only IT specialty. And these requirements are much broader. They would encompass anything that one might be considered a specialty area. Maybe it's a specialty area of accounting. Certainly IT still considered in there. Forensic services, even appraisers, actuaries, anything that might be considered a special skill or knowledge. The idea is to think about whether those persons are needed to complete the audit. And then if a specialist, if you will, is going to be used, the auditor still is required to have enough knowledge of the subject matter to be able to communicate the objectives of the specialist work, to be able to understand where the specialist has in fact met those objectives, and to evaluate how that specialist work affects the relationship to the auditor's other procedures and the auditor's report. So this would, effectively require the auditor to be engaged with the other audit, with the specialist, and not just outsource, if you will, that specialist area. Auditing Standard 10, as I mentioned before, doesn't necessarily create new requirements for supervision, but what it does is update the requirements and explain them in a much more direct way than they have been in our old interim standards. That is, it specifically states that the engagement partner is responsible for the engagement and its performance. It's the engagement partner is responsible for the supervision of the work of engagement team members, and then the standard specifically lays out the necessary nature and extent of supervisory activities. And these activities would apply to also persons that assist the engagement partner in supervision. One of those key principles that's highlighted on the slide there is that the extent of supervision should be commensurate with the risk of material misstatement. So the higher risk areas would be required to have more attention. Auditing standard number 11 replaces the old interim standard that this standard replaces talked about materiality much more from an auditor-centric perspective, the auditor making judgments about materiality. And this standard begins with the concept of materiality that applies under the federal securities laws, which is much more of a reasonable investor perspective. So it requires the auditor, as the old standard did, to establish an appropriate materiality level, but it does articulate it in the concept of thinking about what would be the level of misstatement that would affect the judgment of a reasonable investor. Similarly, there's a requirement to establish lower materiality levels when there are accounts and disclosures where misstatements of lesser amounts are likely to influence the judgment of a reasonable investor. For example, if there are particular accounts or disclosures that are particularly important to investors, then those would be, it could be that those misstatements would, a lower level of misstatement would be important to investors. So in that case, it would require the auditor to lower their materiality level for those accounts. And another thing that's important, another important requirement in this standard is to reevaluate the materiality levels when necessary, when there are changes in circumstances or additional information comes to the auditor's attention that would indicate that a lower level of materiality, if you will, is appropriate. And in that case, the auditor would need to go back and revisit their work and determine what they would need to do to modify their audit procedures to in light of the lower materiality level. AS 12 is the first standard that in the previous slide I had on enhancements. This really is about the process of what the auditor needs to do to identify and assess the risks of material misstatement. It requires the auditor to do work to support their risk, to attain sufficient evidence to support their risk assessments. And it establishes a process that prompts the auditor to connect the dots, if you will, or do the homework necessary, if you will, to identify and appropriately analyze the risks of error or fraud in the financial statements. The standard is designed to be scalable based on the size and complexity of the company, so a larger, more complex company is going to require more effort, more attention, more work in terms to meet the overall objective of the standard of having sufficient evidence to support the risk assessments. These procedures do include specifically procedures for identifying and assessing fraud risks, but perhaps as importantly, during this entire process, the auditor is supposed to be looking at risk, taking all this information into account, and thinking about how what errors or fraud could result from these from the circumstances that that are presented in, with that company. And the standard does include new requirements about forming expectations during the course of understanding the company's selection and implementation of accounting principles. The auditor is required to form some expectations about the disclosures that would be necessary for the financial statements. And during the course of the risk assessment process, there are various requirements related to considering the risks of omitted, incomplete, or inaccurate disclosures. This slide presents to you the categories of risk assessment procedures. Again, this is intended to be a much more holistic process than was presented under the old interim standards, which tended to be much more around your basic nuts and bolts bookkeeping and accounting. This is much more focused around looking at the company, the environment that it operates, the industry, and other matters that could affect the risks of misstatement. And again, designed to highlight for the auditor, to prompt the auditor to think about different ways that things can go wrong with the financial statements. For example, there are a couple of requirements related to looking at executive compensation and whether or not there may be incentives or pressures from executive compensation arrangements that might present risks of material misstatement of the financial statement. So there's a rather comprehensive process that the auditor is required to go through to understand the types of things that can go wrong with the financial statements. And coming out of this, there are really three outputs to the risk assessment process. One of them is just simply once they've identified the risk, an assessment of the risk, what's the likelihood, magnitude of misstatements related to the risk, then there are a couple of other pieces to it that really then set the stage for the linkage that we'll talk about. The identification of significant accounts and disclosures and their relevant assertions. These concepts have been around in PCAOB standards for a while. They were originally defined in AS5, and they essentially boil down to looking at whether there's a reasonable possibility of misstatement in the accounts and disclosures and assertions that could result, that would result in material misstatement of the financial statements. And then the companion to that is significant risks, which are risks that require special audit consideration. And they do, by definition, include fraud risks. So the auditor goes through this process, assesses the risks, and then identifies these significant accounts and disclosures and significant risks. That sets the stage for auditing standard number 13, which is where they really apply that and are required to link in those risk assessments to the actual conduct of their audit. And they're required to respond to the risk of material misstatement through overall responses, which get into, which are things such as the staffing and scheduling, incorporating an element of unpredictability, those kinds of responses, which under our old interim standards were just restricted to fraud risk. They're now holistically designed to apply to all the risks of material misstatement. And then there are responses involving the nature, timing, and extent of audit procedures. Here we're talking about tests of controls and the substantive procedures of tests of accounts. The auditor's required to perform procedures that address each of the risks of material misstatement that they've identified, and they're specifically required to perform substantive tests for each relevant assertion of each significant account and disclosure. And for the larger companies that have the ICFR audit, in that area, you may recall the auditor's required to perform tests of controls for relevant assertions. So you see this process has aligned the testing of the testing for the financial statement audit with the audit of internal control. In the area of tests of controls, it's important to note that the requirements around tests of controls for the financial statement audit are designed, again, to align with AS5 so that in the respect that if there's a similar concept like the nature of tests of controls, timing of tests of controls, those concepts use the same language. So it's easy to understand the relationship among the two. But I also point out that for audits of only financial statements, non-accelerated filers, for example, they still have the same flexibility that they did before in determining when to test controls. So essentially, in most cases, they would perform tests of controls only in those situations where they intend to rely on controls. If there are fraud risks or other significant risks, the auditor is required to perform audit procedures that are specifically responsive to the risks. So they would need to have procedures that are specifically mapped to those risks, and they would also need to perform tests of details in response to, as part of their response to those risks. So they wouldn't be able to just perform tests of controls, analytical procedures in those cases. They would need to actually, if you will, get their hands dirty and actually perform some detailed testing in those areas. In terms of evaluating audit results, this standard is intended to provide, as I mentioned before, a comprehensive evaluation of the audit evidence that's obtained, both positive evidence and negative evidence. And the process was brought together this way partially in light of observations that auditors at times had not always evaluated all the evidence before them, especially when they found contrary evidence. So this standard requires the auditor to look at all the evidence that they've obtained, to evaluate the results of that evidence, and also to step back and form a specific conclusion about whether or not they've obtained enough evidence to support their opinion. And the standard has a process that, again, walks the auditor through an evaluation of all the relevant aspects of their audit evidence, including uncorrected misstatements and conditions identified during the audit that would relate to their assessment of fraud risk. So there are a number of things that they put together. Some of these are not entirely new, although many of this discussion has been updated. I think it's important to note that when we're talking about aiming for a comprehensive evaluation of the evidence, that under the old interim standards, one would have had to look to flip through five different auditing standards to find this kind of to find analogous requirements. So there's a certain amount of pulling this together and also updating and improving the requirements in this area. Some examples of newer enhanced requirements on this standard, there are the old requirements around evaluating misstatements and estimates were somewhat generalized. The updated requirement specifically directs the auditor to look at accounting estimates and evaluate it in two respects. One is, does it comply with the accounting standard? Second of all, is it reasonable? And if it's outside that very reasonableness, then it's considered a misstatement. There's also a much more discussion in the standard about evaluating potential management bias in the financial statements. And there are some specific additional procedures for situations where the auditor identifies a misstatement and management identifies an offsetting adjustment. The auditor is specifically required to go on to perform procedures to understand why this new offsetting adjustment wasn't identified previously, and also to consider the implications of that situation on their views of management integrity and fraud risk. The audit evidence standard establishes the requirement that the auditor needs to design and perform audit procedures to obtain sufficient appropriate audit evidence. Also importantly, when we're talking about in the risk assessment area, obtaining sufficient evidence to support the auditor's risk assessments, in the response area to performing work to obtain sufficient appropriate evidence to addressing the risks, this standard really outlines what it means, what sufficiency means, what appropriateness means, how to evaluate the relevance and reliability of audit evidence. So this is a key, the standard here provides key principles that underline the other standards in the suite. And it also has a section on that discusses the auditor's responsibility for selecting items for testing. This standard, because these standards were so foundational, there were many amendments to the standards, a fairly lengthy list. Some of them are, the lion's share of them are actually just technical amendments, but there are a few amendments that standards that were amended that I would like to highlight that I think are important. One is auditing standard 3 was amended to explicitly require the auditor to document a summary of the identified risk and the assessment of those risks and the responses, including how the responses link to the risk assessments. And we think that will be very useful for auditors within that are performing supervision and review. They're important for the engagement quality reviewer and determining that they've actually addressed all the risks that they've identified. The substantive analytical procedures, AU329 has been amended to essentially focus only on substantive analytical procedures in light of some observations that auditors have had challenges with performing analytical procedures that meet the requirements of our standard. We have a standard now that focuses solely on what you need to do when you're performing analytical procedures as a test of an account or disclosure. The audit sampling standard has been amended to enhance the requirements around determining sample sizes and non-statistical samples. And AU336 and AU543, essentially they were amended. The primary amendments there are to help explain to the auditor when they need to look to those standards and when they need to look to auditing standard number 10. As was mentioned in the earlier session, we currently have standard setting projects that will likely result in replacing, if not substantially amending, both AU336 and 543. And lastly, AU316, although many requirements have been integrated from AU316 into the suite of eight risk assessment standards, it's important to note that the that standard continues to have a lot of important information in it. It now has a roadmap that explains how the auditor's consideration of fraud is accomplished throughout the audit process, and it continues to have a lot of important requirements around the auditor's responses to management override, including testing of journal entries, looking at management tests for management bias related to accounting estimates, and those kinds of matters. And finally, looking, I guess, to today and to the future in terms of standard setting process, I think it's easier to think of these standards, although they outline the essentials of the audit process, they also serve as a framework for any standard setting that we do that relates to audit planning procedures, procedures around assessing risk, procedures around performing audit procedures in response to risk. All of those core elements are there in place and can be built on. So, for example, we have a confirmation standard. It can look to confirmation is a procedure that's performed in response to risk. So it can build on those principles in the risk assessment standards and talk about things that where one might use confirmation in response to significant risk, for example. Also, there are we've mentioned things around use of specialists that could be helpful to the specialists project, and also as they think about the auditor engaging or employing a specialist and them being supervised and what additional they can focus on, what additional requirements may be necessary for proper supervision of a specialist. And another example of the principal auditor project, I think, will be able to leverage some of the work that's already been done around multi-location scoping. So I think these standards will be able to be leveraged, and we would look to leverage them in any situation where we're talking about standards setting around audit procedures. And that concludes my remarks. So thank you.
Mary Hartman Mars.
Oh, thank you for that, Keith. I did have a quick question. On AS number 3, on audit documentation, and as you went through it, I think this is a really robust information that can be provided. But I was wondering, is it considered that this is going to be auditor communication to the audit committee? And then, are they going to be able to provide that kind of information to the audit committee? And then, of course, from the investor's perspective, I know there's a lot of questions about that, but it would be nice to know if there's something that might be in even summary format that would go to investors as well.
Well, the amendments to AS3 obviously only relate to audit documentation. Certainly, if there are matters in there that are considered important, they can be thought about and incorporated into the project on communications with the audit committee. So there's an opportunity to do that, and I know we've had discussions during the course of the development of that proposed standard about trying to make sure we were talking about similar concepts using similar language and that sort of thing. So certainly there's an opportunity to do that.
Galen Hanson.
Yes, thanks a lot, Keith. I really appreciate it. I do have a question on Standard 13. And it has to do with this notion of assessing control risk below the maximum, which has been a concept that's been out there for some time. I thought the Auditing Standards Board, when they updated their risk assessment suite, to call it that, got rid of that that notion and sort of forced the issue with practitioners where that wasn't an out. You couldn't just say that you had assessed controls at maximum. Really, what does that mean? And I don't know if that is still in the standard or was just in the preparation of this slide, but I thought we were trying to basically give firms no other choice other than they've got to understand the environment, they have to understand the controls, and then make their assessment. Am I wrong about that?
The standards would actually, they may not have exactly the same language that you're describing, but the effect is the same. The auditor is still going to be required to, as part of the risk assessment process, to understand the internal control over financial reporting, including evaluating the design. If there are significant risks, they have to specifically understand the controls that are in place to address those significant risks and to evaluate design related to that. The point that I was referring to was essentially saying that if the auditor wants to rely on controls to assess control risk below maximum, then they would need to test the design and operating effectiveness of those controls. So it's more that you can't rely on controls if you don't test them. That's essentially the point.
Gary Kaybrook.
Thank you, Marty. And let me begin by just complimenting the entire organization. I thought this is a really well-written, integrated set of new standards. Even if a lot of it's pulling together old stuff, it was time for a good refresh. And it really is a good work product. But the Keith, and I suppose the answer has to be based on the feedback you receive from the auditing firms. But in what way, if any, do you expect any consequential changes in audits going forward? Again, assuming a reasonably well-executed audit against the current standards, are you expecting to see any important changes that are sort of pervasive and broad-based? And again, if the auditing firms want to respond as opposed to you, I'll be willing to hear whoever has to say what about it. Thanks.
Well, certainly a number of the improvements in the standards could be described as things that good auditors do now. Okay, so things where we use the example of evaluating executive compensation and seeing if there are risks posed by that. Certainly, that's something that some auditors are doing now. And a number of other things would be things that some auditors are doing now, and to some extent. I mean, there is an extent to which what we've done is updated and improved the standards related to so that these are now requirements and not just best practices beyond the standards. I suppose that some of this is going to bear out depending upon what individual firm methodologies require. I would hope that if there wasn't already, there'd be a much more integrated and robust consideration of fraud, for example. I hope that this will also help, in some cases, firms better integrate their audit, when they're performing integrated audits, integrate their audit of internal control with their audit of financial statements, and hopefully position them to more effectively link their responses to the risks that they identify. Those are some examples, and hopefully perhaps at least apply more diligence in the evaluation of the audit process. So.
And we think the standards help auditors go through the audit process in a much more logical, disciplined fashion. By the structure in which these standards are designed and the process through which they take the auditor. So we think that hopefully that's an improvement, just the process by which the organization of these take place.
I'm sorry.
Paul Sobel?
This question may just show how uninformed I am, but it's kind of a philosophical question. I was reminded back in your discussion on standard number 11 about this reasonable investor perspective concept, and you know, it got me thinking, as I have in the past, you know, doesn't that kind of require, for example, you know, Wayne to get into Mary's mind and say, what would she consider to be material, and does Mary represent the other, you know, current investors and potential future investors? And, you know, maybe, you know, it says, you know, as applied under the current federal security laws, maybe there's enough guidance for that, but I was wondering, maybe this is a question for the firms, you know, how do you make that judgment? Is there research that has shown here's typically what investors think about materiality? Are they more or less risk-averse than the auditors? Has there been enough cases that we've been able to glean that information, or am I just getting way too esoteric with this question?
The question does come up from time to time. I think the way that I would I think this is, well, first of all, in a sense, this is not new. This is the standard auditors have been held to. It just hasn't been recognized in the auditing standards as well. I think part of the, I mean, there is sort of a technical way to think about this, but there, I think more importantly, this hopefully will prompt auditors to have the right mindset. In some cases, you might see situations where an auditor might have a certain approach to materiality that might help get their sample sizes to where they want them to be, but have a hard time rationalizing how that approach to considering materiality has any relationship to something that would be important to an investor when they're looking at the financial statement. So hopefully that will have it will create more of a investor perspective mindset on the auditor in that sense.
I'll add to that just a little bit. I think, as Keith said, it's not new, that's first of all, but it is newly articulated right in the standard here. And hopefully it really does prompt the auditor by being in the standard. If the auditor concludes, well, this is a 3% difference in net income and that's not material in the auditor's view, well, that's not the important factor. The only important factor, the factor is, would that be important to a reasonable investor to make sure that that conclusion is reached based upon what would a reasonable investor think about that difference? How did that investor think about that difference in a trend or whatever it might be? So it's been in the law, but I think it prompts someone to make that right decision regarding either a quantitative disclosure or a quantitative amount or a qualitative situation in terms of, yeah, that's one omitted compliance disclosure. Yeah, but is it one on which a reasonable investor would find that to be very important, that fact, had he or she known it in the total mix of things? So, again, is it radical? No. But it's intended to reinforce the concepts right in the standards of what materiality is in accordance with federal securities laws. Who's next? Lynn Turner.
Marty, I got a question on the slide on auditing standard number 14. And it comes up in the context of also the report that the board issued with respect to its inspections of audits. And there's been some writings on this. And the issue is, in determining whether there's sufficient appropriate audit evidence to have been obtained, do you interpret this standard to say that the auditor needs to look not only for evidence that would corroborate the assumptions or the numbers or the methodology that management has put forward, or would you interpret this to say that the auditor also needs to seek out, if it exists, and consider contrary information when such contrary information does exist out there? It seems that your inspection report seems to say that the auditor would need to consider both, that they couldn't just look to corroborating information. But is that how you would interpret this standard now, that the auditor has to look for both? They can't just be blinded and look for one in absence of the other?
Yeah, the short answer is yes. The auditors needs to consider, they need to perform appropriate procedures to respond to the risk. They get evidence that points in the other direction that says the number may not be correct, and that evidence has to be considered. It's specifically required in the standard.
But does the auditor need to look for that information? Obviously, and in part this goes to the question that Gary just raised, because I think it's a good question. In the past, and according to your inspection reports, auditors were just seeking out corroborating information. Does this say that the auditor can't just take what management has given in the form of corroborating information, but they also have to seek out if there's contrary information reasonably available out there, that they should be aware of that and look to that as well? Or is it only if someone all of a sudden drops it on their doorsteps that they got to consider it?
Well, I don't think it's the latter. I think that the auditor has to, the requirement essentially is to obtain relevant and reliable evidence. So that's going to be from whatever the best sources of information are. It's a little bit difficult to say categorically they have to go out and search for something that who knows what it is, then just for the purpose of trying to find something that's different, but that's contrary. But I guess the principal point is you can't just take management's word for it. You cannot just take an assertion without actually looking for it and looking for evidence that's objective and reliable.
Comment on that,
Marty.
Too, and maybe an example of auditing the allowance for loan losses. If management's made an assertion that the allowance for loan losses is reduced because they believe that economic conditions in a certain area this year improved, and they expect, therefore, that there's fewer job losses, et cetera, than they initially thought, I think the auditor has a responsibility. I believe the auditor has a responsibility under this standard to understand that assertion management made, and also whether the facts support that, and whether there is evidence about the economic conditions that would indicate, no, job losses are increasing and not decreasing. And so not to simply accept the look for corroborative evidence that the conditions improved, but look also to see if there's evidence that conditions haven't improved. So I believe the answer to your question is yes.
Yeah, I think the other part that's important to bring out here is, again, even stepping back to AS-12 and doing your homework to be able to understand the environment, the company well enough to be able to recognize those situations that might not quite ring true, and to understand where there may be contrary evidence that would call into question management's assertion.
You also mentioned that the standard requires the auditor to, consider the risk of fraud and hopefully become a more robust consideration than we had in the past. And surveys and evidence indicates that the number one way we find fraud is through whistleblower hotlines and or that it's done through period-end audit adjustments. To what extent would you interpret that this then requires the auditor to take a look at that whistleblower hotline and how it's working and whether it brings fraud to one's attention? And also, to what extent then does this risk assessment require the auditor to take a look at those year-end or period-end adjustments?
Well, let me take them in reverse order. There's specific requirements around looking at and testing the period-end close process and looking at the adjustments that are made in the financial statements and reconciling back from the financial statements to the underlying accounting records. So I think there's pretty robust testing in that area. There's also, during the part of the risk assessment, one of the risk assessment procedures is getting an understanding of how that whistleblower process is working and what information is coming out of that whistleblower process. So it is part of the, it's in within the scope of the risk assessment procedures.
Is the whistleblower specifically discussed at all in the standard?
In auditing standard 12, it's part of when the auditor's trying to, it's in part of the process making inquiries to understand what kinds of information that they may have, may have come to light from the whistleblower process.
Jeff Mahoney.
Thank you. Just to follow up on Gary's earlier question, there's certainly been some anecdotal evidence over the years that both management and auditors, let's say, care in looking at the numbers in financial statement footnotes is a little bit different than the care and effort put into numbers that are in the face of financial statements. I guess one example in recent history has been stock option expenses, where they were disclosed in the footnotes for many, many years, and then when it was finally required to be put in the income statement, we found that in many cases the footnote disclosures had not been complied with by many companies for many years. So my question is follow-up to Gary's question. Is there something in here that you expect will create any kind of significant change in practice in how audit practices are with respect to footnote disclosures?
Well, as I mentioned before, disclosures was an important consideration when we were looking at the formulating the requirements and the risk assessment standards. We do have sort of on the front end and the back end requirements to, first of all, form some expectations about what the required procedures ought to be. And during the risk assessment process, at various points, to consider the risks of omitted, incomplete, or inaccurate disclosure. So that's a specifically identified risk area that the auditor has to look at. And then where there are risks, they're required to respond to that. And then at the end, as part of evaluating, one of the things you evaluate as part of evaluating audit results is evaluating the presentation of the financial statements and whether the financial statements include the information that is essential for the fair presentation of the financial statements. So, again, there's the look back on the end and the conclusion on the end about looking at whether the financial statements include the necessary disclosure. So there's a lot more emphasis, and it's baked into a core part of the process and the standards. So I would expect that should at least raise awareness and hopefully will provide more diligence and attention to that particular area.
Gail Hansen.
Thank you. In the Form 10-K, management is required to have certain risk disclosures, and I was wondering how these risk assessment standards coordinate with management's own disclosures of their risk.
Well, that would be certainly an input into the process, that something that the auditor would look at and understand management's process for identifying risk and responding to risk. That's a specific part of their risk assessment process. So it's one of the things that the auditor is required to look at, and should be informed by that when they're doing their own risk assessments and responding to those.
Wayne Collins.
Yeah, I just want to go back to the issue that Lynn had raised before, talking about the looking for contrary evidence. Seemed that whole discussion could be wrapped around the concept, the fundamental concept of auditor skepticism. So based on the auditor's understanding of the business, looking at what evidence he or she needs to corroborate an assertion, continuously asking the question, does that make sense based on what I know about the business? So I would think that they looking for contrary evidence would be taken up by adopting an appropriate professional skeptical attitude.
Right, and to underscore that point, there are multiple places in the standards that point out the importance of professional skepticism. In the brainstorming session, it required an AS-12 as part of the auditor's response in AS-13. And specifically, there's discussion in the standard about not taking management's responses at face value and obtaining corroboration and reassessing your risk assessments if you're investigating further if management's giving you answers that don't seem to they seem vague or unresponsive or raise concern. So it is multiple points in the standard addressed.
Thanks, Wayne. That's a good point. Neary Buxman?
One of the slides pointed to connecting the dots, so what I'd like to do is also try to connect some of the dots as well. I'll start with echoing Jeff's comment about disclosures and also connecting it to comments that, Marty, you made earlier as far as challenges in auditing fair value, and given that some of those fair value has been previously audited in the notes, one would say that those challenges should be commensurate with what have been experienced all along if, in fact, the same auditing procedures have been applied, give or take, you know, a couple degrees of freedom because it's been somewhat more challenging environment in the recent past. But more broadly, in the context of connecting the dots and risk assessment, I would think, and the comment was made, what necessary disclosures are. I would think that the disclosures could be used in two purposes, right? One is you go into the financial statement, look at you audit the numbers, then you look at the footnotes, and you audit the footnotes. But if you do your risk assessment, you actually can reverse the order. You can actually look at the footnotes and say, do the footnotes telling me the story that will allow me to understand whether the numbers are correct? So there could be some element of joining the interaction or the audit interaction in a more holistic or harmonized process between the footnotes and the audits, and also the comment made earlier about the reasonable investor could also be connected. Stated differently, it's not the necessary disclosure, but if I'm a reasonable investor and I read the disclosure, I can develop expectations about the number. If I look at the number, I can understand from the disclosure what the numbers are telling me. So some mindset about necessary disclosure can actually detract from the mission that you're trying to achieve with providing the disclosure. So just, it's a nuance, but I think this is some of the sound bites that you get just by reading it and just by listening to the discussion.
You make a good point, and part of the idea about forming the expectations is just early on, because as you're understanding the business, as you're understanding the operations of the company, thinking about what kinds of disclosures would you expect to find in the financial statements, and just early on thinking about those things during the risk assessment process, and which should help form your conclusion when you're stepping back and evaluating whether the financial statements are presented fairly.
Thanks, Neary. This is an important standard-setting step forward for the PCAOB. As we're developing standards, whether it be on confirmations, which we discussed earlier, or the use of specialists, which we've had quite a bit of discussion of, or the importance of considerations on the use of other auditors, each of those standard-setting projects, as we're doing them, we look back to what we've done in these risk assessment standards, and Keith's a consultant now in every project we do, as we think through linking together all of our standard setting together with these foundational aspects, as we've called them. This discussion will be brought on the road quite a bit, whether it be at the small business forums that I think many of you are aware of that we have with auditors of smaller businesses. As Keith said, many of the larger firms have risk-based processes, so building these in may not be as much of a challenge as for some smaller firms. But we expect to do a lot of discussions of these standards in various different forums, and indicating with this presentation and others what they intend to do and how we intend that they would change practice and influence auditing standards and practice. So with that, thank you very much for your comments and questions on this subject. Keith, thanks for your presentation. And we'll now move forward to Paul Bijou and Helen Munter, who are going to join us. Paul and Helen are deputy directors in Division of Registration and Inspections, two of the lead inspectors in the group. and they're going to give an overview of the observations regarding audits during the economic crisis. Before Paul and Helen do that, Bill Gradisson is going to make a couple of words about this project.
Thank you, Marty. I know we're all looking forward to this presentation, and I'm not going to take too much time because we want to get down to the substance. I would like to comment, though, that this 4010 report draws attention to what the board, subject to the statutory limitations on disclosure about auditors and issuers, what we are able to say, and which is a lot. And it certainly causes me to build upon what Dan mentioned this morning. It would be very helpful, not necessarily at this moment, but if you all, any of you, have ideas, as you've come to know more about what we actually have in the way of information, if you have ideas on future 4010s, areas you'd like us to comment on, let us know, because we are really anxious to share what has really become a wealth of information through the 4010 process. With regard to the economic downturn, as mentioned earlier, an audit alert was put out to remind firms of the special challenges during this period. And this, in a sense, is a follow-up. It's very comprehensive in terms of the number of different audit and accounting areas that it examined, and also comprehensive in the sense that it covers a three-year period. This, I think, gives some sense then, in a sense, a solid basis for the conclusions that it reaches. And while it's certainly not the end of the exploration, it may at least begin to answer a question that we're hearing now and then with regard to the economic downturn. Where were the auditors? With that background, I'm happy to turn it over to Helen and Paul, and only want to conclude by saying that all of our inspection staff who were involved in putting this report together had to did an extraordinary job. There's lots of pieces that have to be pulled together here. It is not easy to put these together, and they deserve a lot of credit for what they've done.
Thank you, Bill. Appreciate the opportunity to address the group. Usually, I try to strategically place myself near the screen so that I can read the slides as carefully as I can. To do that today, I'd have to turn my back on you and read it over here. There's probably no hope of me reading it down there, but perhaps that's something many of you can relate to, I guess.
Make it bigger next time.
The board has issued the 4010 report to inform the public concerning the audit risk and challenges that it has identified through its inspection program as a result of the disruption in credit and financial markets and the broader economic downturn. This report covers aspects of the board's work during the cycle 2007, 2008, and 2009 relating to domestic registered firms. The audit deficiencies identified in this report have been communicated to the firms through PCAOB comment forms or inspection reports for the years in question, and in many cases, the deficiencies are described in the public portion of these inspection reports. These reports collect and summarize in a single document audit deficiencies in areas that were significantly affected by the economic crisis. The deficiencies are provided as an illustrative examples of the type of deficiencies that inspectors identified when inspecting audits. Identification of these deficiencies should not be construed as suggesting a pervasive issue existing in these particular audit areas. The board's statutory mission is to protect the interests of investors, as you know, and to further the public interest in the preparation of informative, fair, and independent audit reports. The information in this report is intended to provide investors with insight into how the PC, how the board fulfills that mission. This report should also be useful to investors and to other financial statement users as they review and evaluate audited financial statements that include disclosures in the areas discussed in this report. In addition, registered firms, audit committees, and other standard setters might find the information in the report useful. Particularly, for registered firms, firms must determine how to strengthen their quality controls in order to minimize the likelihood of future audit deficiencies. The board urges all registered public accounting firms to review this report and consider whether the auditing problems that the board has observed could manifest themselves in the firm's practice. As it relates to audit committees might find this report of interest in at least two respects. First, the auditing challenges discussed in this report parallel financial reporting challenges. Audit committees might want to consider and discuss in detail with financial reporting management how the issuer addresses such matters as fair value measurements, impairment determinations, and loan loss reserve calculations. Second, the audit committee might wish to discuss with the issuer's auditor the auditor's assessment of audit risk in these areas, what the auditor's strategy will be in addressing these risks, and the results of audit procedures performed related to those risks. With respect to other standard setters, the board is mindful that the accounting standards setters, in particular the Financial Accounting Standards Board and the International Accounting Standards Board, have embarked on an ambitious agenda to revise applicable accounting and financial reporting requirements. The accounting principles related to several of the challenging audit areas discussed in this report are on that agenda.
The report contains four sections. First off is a discussion of the board's inspection process and how it responded to the increased audit risks presented by the adverse economic events. Following that, the inspection staff observations are presented, including a discussion of deficiencies identified by inspectors in certain audit areas and examples of specific deficiencies, which we believe are very helpful to help frame the issues we tend to encounter. Next, the report discusses the board's response to the identified areas of audit deficiencies and finally describes the board's ongoing efforts to address additional audit risks posed by economic crisis or any similar future events. Let me talk for a little bit about the inspection process. A key element of many of the board's programs, including the inspection program, is the monitoring of economic events. The board's inspection staff monitor developments and emerging audit risks related to the economic crisis, interacting with other PCAOB offices and divisions, our Office of Research and Analysis and the Office of the Chief Auditor, and also using publicly available information. The inspection process relies on two techniques to assess firms' audit quality during the period covered by an inspection. First off, inspectors review a firm's work on numerous audits selected by us without any firm influence. Second, inspectors evaluate the design and effectiveness of a firm's quality control policies and procedures that could be expected to have an effect on audit performance. The selection of issuer audits for review is influenced by an evaluation of the risk that issuers' financial statements could be materially misstated. This risk might relate to characteristics of the particular issuer or its industry, or the audit issues likely to be encountered. Given the effect of the economic crisis on the financial services industry, audits of larger, more complex financial institutions were an area of focus for our program for the last few years. Inspection staff used internally and externally prepared industry research, as well as other data and analysis, to identify and evaluate risk factors attributable to the overall financial services industry and to specific sectors within the financial services industry, such as the banking, securities, and insurance sectors. Within each of these sectors, other accounting and product risk factors were considered, such as the subprime mortgage exposure, commercial mortgage exposure, and complex transactions.
Thank you, Helen. The next three slides will take us through specific observations by the inspection staff. As the effects of the economic crisis spread to the broader economy, the board's inspection staff considered additional audit risk factors, as well as audit risk factors previously considered, that had become more significant during the 2009 inspection cycle. As you can see, we've categorized these deficiencies, and the first group is the deficiencies identified in audits of both financial and non-financial industry users. Specifically, fair value measurements is an area of comment. Fair value measurements are used to establish or evaluate the recorded values of many categories of assets and liabilities. The economic crisis increased uncertainty regarding issuers' estimates of fair value, which significantly increased audit risk, issuers' fair value measurements, and disclosures are often important to investors relying on issuers' financial statements. PCAOB standards require that the auditor test management's fair value measurements and disclosures and consider using the work of a specialist in performing audit procedures related to the fair value. Now let me get a little bit more specific to fair value measurements for financial instruments. Certain financial instruments, including certain investments in debt and equity securities, derivatives, and certain loans, are required to be reported in issuers' financial statements at fair value. The valuation of certain financial instruments might be subject to an increased risk of material misstatement because, for example, the valuation methods used might be complex and market participants might employ different valuation techniques. Inspectors observed that firms sometimes plan to test issuers' estimates of fair value for financial instruments by performing procedures that included evaluating the reasonableness of the issuer's significant assumptions and testing the valuation model and the underlying data. In some of these instances, deficiencies observed by inspectors included failures of the firm to evaluate sufficiently whether the fair value measurements were determined using appropriate valuation methods or adequately test controls over the issuer's valuation processes. The firm may have failed to evaluate sufficiently the reasonableness of management's significant assumptions, including performing tests beyond inquiries of management, or failed to evaluate the available evidence that was inconsistent with the issuer's fair value estimates. In other cases, inspectors observed that firms evaluated issuers' estimates of fair value for financial instruments by developing an independent expectation of fair value for corroborative purposes. In many of these cases, the firms used external pricing services or external valuation specialists. Inspection teams observed instances in which the firm sometimes failed to understand the methods or assumptions used by these external parties. In addition, inspection teams sometimes observe failures by firms to evaluate significant differences between independent estimates used or developed by firms and the fair values recorded by the issuers. Inspectors also observed instances in which firms sometimes fail to test or test sufficiently significant difficult-to-value securities. Inspectors also observed instances in which firms sometimes fail to perform sufficient tests to determine whether issuers' fair value disclosures were in conformity with the requirements of SFAS 157. Now, the second category I wanted to address on the slide concerns non-financial assets, as well as the impairment of goodwill, indefinite-lived intangible assets, and other long-lived assets. The adverse changes in market conditions, which generally reduced issuers' profits and market capitalizations, increase the risk of impairment of goodwill and other indefinite-lived intangible assets and other long-lived assets. Goodwill and other indefinite-lived intangible assets are required to be evaluated for impairment annually or more frequently when events or changes in circumstances indicate an asset might be impaired or that the fair value of the reporting unit had fallen below its carrying value. Other long-lived assets are required to be tested for recoverability whenever events or changes in circumstances indicate that the carrying amounts might not be recoverable. Inspectors observed that firms sometimes fail to challenge issuers' conclusions that goodwill did not need to be tested for impairment more frequently than annually, despite the evidence of impairment indicators, such as recent declines in issuer stock prices or reduced estimates of future revenue in situations where such declines or reductions appeared to be potentially significant to the issuer's most recent impairment analysis. In addition, inspectors observed that firms sometimes fail to test or test appropriately issuers' assessments that other indefinite-lived intangible assets or other long-lived assets were not impaired. The other category wanted to focus on pertains specifically to the financial services industry issues. And, of course, the allowance for loan losses is the most significant element. The allowance for loan loss is one of the most significant estimates made by many issuers in the financial services industry. The economic crisis was accompanied by significant increases in credit losses, delinquencies, and non-performing assets of many financial services issuers, as well as an increase in bank failures. Inspectors observed that firms often plan to evaluate the reasonableness of the allowance by reviewing and testing management's process for developing the estimate. Inspectors sometimes identified deficiencies that included the firm's failure to sufficiently test specific reserves on impaired loans, failed to evaluate sufficiently the effect on the allowance of deficiencies identified in management's process, and alter the nature, timing, and extent of the testing in the allowance in light of the identified deficiencies. They failed to sufficiently evaluate the reasonableness of management's significant assumptions used to develop the allowance, including the assumptions about the nature and size of qualitative adjustments. Firms failed to test sufficiently the data underlying management's calculation of the allowance for loan losses. In other cases, firms evaluated the reasonableness of issuers' allowance by developing an independent expectation of that allowance. Inspection teams observed that when this approach was used, firms sometimes failed to obtain evidence to support the assumptions they used or test the completeness and accuracy of the issuer's data. Inspectors sometimes observe deficiencies with firms' procedures for auditing estimates when firms reviewed events or transactions that occurred subsequent to the balance sheet date, but prior to the date of the auditor's opinion. Some comments on off-balance sheet structures. Commitments to provide financial support or guarantees might be in place between issuers and off-balance sheet structures, including special purpose entities and variable interest entities created through the securitization or other transactions. During the economic crisis, implicit and informal guarantees or other arrangements to provide financial support became explicit between some financial services issuers and off-balance sheet structures. This, in turn, should have caused some issuers to reevaluate the accounting for these off-balance sheet structures. Inspectors sometimes observed deficiencies in the firm's audit procedures related to off-balance sheet structures. Specifically, firms sometimes failed to sufficiently test issuers' transactions with external parties or special purpose entities to determine whether such transactions were appropriately accounted for, or test the ongoing compliance with accounting requirements by certain off-balance sheet arrangements, including performing tests for the occurrence of events that would affect the accounting for these arrangements. And finally, on this slide, some comments about other than temporary impairment for certain investments. Investors are required to assess assess whether any declines in fair value below cost are other than temporary. The economic crisis was accompanied by significant declines in fair value of many debt and equity securities held by issuers. Inspectors sometimes observed that firms failed to adequately evaluate issuers' conclusions that a decline in the fair value of securities was not other than temporary. In these instances, inspection teams observed deficiencies that included firms' failures to evaluate, beyond inquiries of management, certain significant assumptions underlying issuers' assessments that investments in debt and equity securities were not impaired, including securities for which fair value had been below cost for a period of greater than 12 months. B, evaluate issuers' assertions regarding their intent and ability to hold securities for a period of time sufficient to allow for any anticipated recovery in fair value. And C, consider contradictory evidence, such as sales of securities or contractual agreements that would call into question whether the issuers had the intent and the ability to hold the investment until recovery.
With respect to the audits that we looked at of non-financial services issuers, there's three categories of deficiency that I'd like to address. First off is revenue recognition. Many material misstatements due to fraudulent financial reporting involve inappropriate recognition of revenue. The adverse economic environment might have increased pressure to meet revenue targets and analyst expectations, or increased difficulty in meeting those targets. These pressures increase the risk of material misstatement of the financial statements by creating incentives for management to fraudulently recognize revenue, or could result in issuers changing their business practices as a means to affect the amount and timing of revenue recognition, which would in turn require a corresponding change to audit procedures. Inspectors sometimes observed deficiencies in firms' procedures to test revenue recognition, including failures to appropriately respond to specific risks, including fraud risk, related to revenue recognition by, for example, evaluation as to whether the timing of revenue recognition was appropriate, failing to sufficiently test the estimated fair value of all elements in arrangements with multiple deliverables, failing to identify and test relevant internal controls, or to adequately respond to test exceptions. We also highlighted problems with respect to the appropriate testing of issuer-generated reports or schedules used to record revenue. With respect to the valuation of inventory, frequently inventory is stated at the lower of cost or market, and in some cases the reduction in the level of consumer and business spending that occurred during the recent adverse economic environment resulted in increased inventory in relation to sales levels, reduction in inventory turnover, and declining sales prices. These factors might have resulted in excess or obsolete inventory, or inventory whose cost basis exceeded a market value. Inspectors sometimes observe deficiencies related to a failure to sufficiently evaluate the reasonableness of reserves established by management with respect to excess and obsolete inventory, failures to adequately test whether impaired inventory had been appropriately identified and measured by issuers, and failures to consider whether markdowns were recorded when necessary to support the proper valuation of inventory under the retail method. In the area of income taxes, We noted problems with respect to the accounting for deferred tax assets and liabilities, which had been recorded for expected future tax consequences of events already recognized in the financial statements or in tax returns. At times, the outcome of tax position might be uncertain, and sometimes it might be unclear if a deferred tax asset will ultimately result in tax benefits. Estimates made by issuers regarding the recoverability of deferred tax assets, as well as the outcome of uncertain tax positions, might require significant management judgment, increasing the risk of material misstatement. Observed deficiencies included failures with respect to the evaluation as to whether issuers placed appropriate weight on forecasts of taxable income in light of uncertainty created by the economy and the existence of recent losses. We noted failures to adequately test reductions in issuers' deferred tax asset valuation allowances because, for example, a firm did not test whether there was sufficient positive evidence to outweigh substantial negative evidence. And finally, failures or deficiencies with respect to the testing of the reasonableness of the assumptions used by issuers in estimating tax contingency reserves. In response to all of these items, audit firms developed several different responses, I guess. And inspectors observed such responses as issuing technical guidance, requiring additional training, developing new audit tools, requiring additional audit procedures, and increasing monitoring of audit personnel. The staff evaluated firms' responses by considering the results of the inspections of issuer audits, including audit deficiencies described in this report, and while efforts have clearly been made, the deficiencies identified by inspectors in their reviews of issuer audits suggest that firms should continue to focus on making improvements to their quality control systems. With respect to the board's response to these deficiencies, they fall into, I guess, four general buckets here. First off is future inspections, and the current economic environment continues to exhibit many of the same risk factors shown and present during the past 3 years. Inspection staff will remain focused on audit areas which have shown deficiencies in the past. In terms of remediation determinations and evaluating whether firms have satisfactorily addressed deficiencies in quality controls, the board will be mindful of the deficiencies discussed in this report, especially to the extent that deficiencies repeat over multiple years for a specific firm. If remediation does not appear to have had the anticipated effect, the board will seek to understand the reasons and evaluate the implications of the continued deficiencies. On the standard-setting front, the board expects to use the observations in the report concerning risks and audit deficiencies associated with the economic crisis to inform its standard-setting. The board will consider whether additional guidance is needed related to existing auditing standards. For example, the audit deficiencies identified with respect to fair value and impairment determinations are relevant to the board's ongoing projects related to auditing fair value measurements and other accounting estimates, as well as to the board's consideration of revisions to the standards regarding the auditor's use of specialists. In terms of enforcement, some of the deficiencies described in this report are currently under review by the board's Division of Enforcement, and in addition, the board's inspection staff takes actions in connection with individual audit deficiencies described in the report, many of which have been described in a public portion of an inspection report already issued. Such actions may include a review of specific remedial action taken by a firm on a specific audit or reinspection of the audit of a specific issuer in a subsequent year.
Okay. So what are we doing, ongoing efforts and initiatives are we following? The board's inspection staff will continue to monitor the ongoing effects of the economic crisis on the auditor performance, including the effects of the economic crisis on audits performed by registered firms located in jurisdictions outside of the United States. The board's inspection program continues to use a risk-based approach by adapting to emerging issues. This enables the board to redirect resources where necessary and change the focus of inspections when appropriate. Board inspection staff continues to interact with other PCAOB programs, as Helen mentioned, in identifying emerging risk areas. In addition, the board's inspection staff continues to work with the OCA to identify opportunities for improving auditing standards on topics for which additional guidance might be needed in light of the inspection observations. And finally, the board's inspection staff continues to monitor developments related to the auditing of fair value measurements. In summary, the board's inspection staff noted firms making efforts to address the risk associated with the economic crisis. Nonetheless, the board's inspection staff noted a number of deficiencies in audit areas that were significantly affected by the economic crisis. Accordingly, continued focus on firms' audit and quality control system remains critical, particularly as they relate to the audit risk posed by the ongoing effects of the economic crisis and any future similar events. The board will continue to direct inspections efforts to monitor the performance of audits and the adequacy of the quality control systems of registered firms so as to achieve its mission of protecting the interests of investors and furthering the public interest in the preparation of informative, fair, and independent audit reports.
Paul and I had a few questions that we'd like to put to the group, so let me start with that at this point. What are the SAG members' views, thoughts, observations regarding the findings in the 4010 report, and do you have views on how the findings should inform future standard-setting projects and priorities?
Barbara Roper? Yeah, thank you. I read the report with great interest, and I agree completely with the comment that was made earlier today about the need to understand the root causes behind these deficiencies in order to make recommendations about how you move forward from here. In other words, I can posit a lot of root causes, and maybe some or all of them apply in different circumstances. In some cases, it may be a lack of clarity in the underlying auditing standard about what the auditors are required to do. In that case, you clarify the audit standards. In some cases, it may be a cost concern that the need to do additional testing and evaluation came at precisely the same time that the firms were under most pressure to reduce their fees. Or it could be a concern about client loss, a simple lack of willingness to challenge or second-guess judgments made by clients when the client themselves was under extreme economic pressure, or lack of expertise or training in some of the highly technical issues. So you need, you know, and clearly you have to understand the why of the failures before you can say what do you do going from here. One of the themes that did jump out at me, though, that in a lot of these areas you are looking at what appears to be either a reluctance or an inability or an unwillingness to do to challenge the judgments made by management, to second guess judgments made by management. And you know, that is something that I think clearly needs to be addressed because by all appearances, FASB and IASB appear to be heading toward accounting standards that require auditors to do more of the things that the evidence suggests they find it most difficult to do. And that has serious long-term implications for the reliability of financial reporting and the quality of audits, in my opinion.
Barbara, thanks for those comments. I think we acknowledged earlier the importance of understanding the root causes, and I think that's a key ingredient here. And we're working with inspections regularly to try to improve root cause analysis to get to some of the points that you mentioned, and that's critical. We will have a discussion tomorrow, as you know, on the agenda, because I agree with the second point also, that clearly the accounting framework, at least as proposed by many of the standards, is changing much more to a greater increase of fair values, greater use, and more importance of difficult accounting estimates, and in areas such as revenue recognition, going from multiple standards for specific industries describing what has to get done to a much more judgment framework in that regard as well. All of these things, if you look at these findings in the context of most of them are in the areas requiring judgment, create cause for concern about the auditability of that new direction. So we agree with those comments, and they're very important. Kurt Schacht.
Thank you. It was a terrific report. I found it to be one of the more interesting ones that I've read. Not that the other reports that you do aren't interesting, but this was particularly particularly interesting. Dan Gelzer mentioned this morning that I guess the bottom line is that the industry didn't cause this. The industry wouldn't necessarily have prevented this. But I think there's a lot of us that are left wondering whether the deficiencies you've identified either separately or collectively, how they contributed to the crisis. Did they exacerbate it? What was the contribution to the crisis? So if you were to give industry a grade, not that maybe that's not fair, maybe if you have any assessment of how industry performed in this crisis or how it was involved in a crisis, I would be interested in hearing that that assessment.
Well, I think it's difficult to, as you allude, to give anybody a grade. Certainly industry, which is not something that we would interface with directly through our inspection program. It's important to note that in our inspection process, we've come upon a good audit work amongst the accounting firms, and we've cited here today the deficiencies that we noted. Now, I suppose certain deficiencies that we've noted, and in particular in significant areas, that may have led to or exacerbated the issue with a particular issue in the sense that it did not bring to the attention of investors potential issues. So I guess that could be a case. But I do want to – I don't want to – overstate that as an issue, that we do find good quality work amongst the firms.
David Silvers.
Well, I think like the other two people have spoken, I'm very pleased to see this report. I think it's long overdue. I think that these questions were evident immediately upon the onset of the financial crisis. And I do want to note, I think this body's former chair, Mark Olson, I think was one of the people who saw that earliest. We are waiting for other reports on the financial crisis still. This report is in our hands. I think the board and the staff deserve credit for that. However, I hope this is in some sense work in progress, because I think in two respects, there's some serious kind of issues raised by the way this has been done. And the first, I think, goes to what Kurt Schacht was asking about before, which I'm going to amplify on. I think there's a fundamental conceptual flaw in this document, which is that it is constructed in terms of talking about the pressures that the economic crisis generated for the quality of audits. Whereas it seems to me the fundamental question here is not that, but rather the way in which the quality of audits helped generate the crisis. And I think there is no way to look at and I think the report is very helpful in terms of the categories it draws out that make that so crystal clear. It is inconceivable to me how we would have had an economic crisis of the kind we had there been proper accounting for loan loss reserves. Had there been proper accounting for the relationship between the special purpose vehicles and their parents. Right. Loan loss reserves are not supposed to be done after the fact when you realize that, oops, you did something risky. Right. They are supposed to be an accounting before the fact of the risks inherent in the activities being undertaken. And it's impossible. I can tell you without having looked at a single report, right, that there was a catastrophic systemic failure of the auditing system to do that. Now, I'm heartened to note that the staff says that enforcement activity is ongoing, because at least in respect to that matter, I cannot imagine how we end up where we are without there being issues for enforcement associated with loan loss reserves. And that's to take one topic and one topic only. Now I want to shift to a second, and I also just can't help resist noting staff's observation about an interest in multiple, the question of whether or not there were problems over multiple years for specific firms. It seems to me that there is, it's unavoidable, it's impossible to conclude otherwise than there were problems around loan loss reserves and off-balance sheet accounting and the auditing thereof, right, for every major financial firm in 2003, 2004, 2005, 2006, 2007, 2008, 2009, and 2010. And it strikes me that constitutes multiple years. Now, if that's not bad enough, we have a whole new field of operation for the PCAOB in this area that's been revealed in the last couple of weeks. And obviously, it's not the board's fault that field of operation is not present in this report. But I think it unavoidably calls for Chapter 2. And I think everyone is familiar generally with what I'm talking about, now is the time to be very specific. We have the actual structure of the mortgage crisis derives from the securitization of mortgages. The center of the securitization process are trusts which issue publicly traded debt securities. Formal actual audits were not done of those trusts, but the big four audit firms had responsibilities with respect to those trusts. Now, I don't know where that leaves the PCAOB. Right? But let me suggest that if it leaves you without jurisdiction to look into the behavior of the audit firms with respect to those entities that are issuing public securities, I think it would be a good idea for the board to inform the Commission and the Congress that you are without that jurisdiction and urge someone else to take it up. And if you have the jurisdiction, I believe you need to start working on it. There is a fundamental question at issue in our financial system today as we sit here. And that question is, are the documents in the collateral files of the trustee banks for those securitization trusts? And by the documents, I mean the mortgage. The fact that question is open is a profound indictment, right, of a lot of people, but among the people it's a profound indictment of are the auditors. When I first heard that question was open about 48 hours ago, I said to the person who's told me, that cannot be true. Those are audited enterprises. They're audited in two senses. They're audited in the sense that the securitization trust has an auditor. Now, what I didn't know at the time that I said that was that they don't do a real audit. But they're also audited in the sense that the trustee or the custodial bank in every case is a publicly traded firm, and that the potential liability for not having ensured that the mortgages and the notes are in the files is sufficient to bankrupt each and every one of them. Where were the auditors who were auditing in that case publicly traded companies under the basic rules and the basic standards of this board, where were they in that circumstance? And those two questions seems to me to go absolutely to the heart of the mission of this board and the consequences of what may have gone wrong here, right, are so extensive that it seems to me this should be an urgent matter for the board.
Jim Cox.
My observations are much more mundane, but we see these things and these questions and this report through the lens where we sit. So just to familiarize everybody, I sit as an academic, but also as an academic who spends a fair amount of his time being both a consumer and a producer of empirical work. So the question I have about this, which I thought was a very good and illuminating report, is on two levels, but they're connected. The first level is that when I read this report, my reaction is that, you know, I wasn't sure whether I should be shocked or glad because I don't know what the N is. You know, I don't know the total number of inspections that you carry out. And so you found these different things, but what if they were only 3% or 5% of everything you looked at? I mean, I don't know what the N is. And, you know, what I would suggest is that when you do these reports and you gather the information, that you do so in a way that collects it in some sort of a systematic way that's going to inform the formation of policy. Because otherwise we just have a series of scenarios when you read this report and you say this, that, and the other. We have no idea whether these were firms that were being audited that had assets and deposits of the billions of dollars. You said they were large. What's large mean, et cetera? And then that relates to another point, which we've heard several references in this morning about the views and or the testimony before the advisory committee on the accounting profession of the Treasury Department. I was there. I remember one of those things, and it relates to the following, that you can't have a good auditing profession in the future unless you have professors who train auditors. And it's very hard in the currency of the realm to be an auditing professor without doing good, solid, empirical, rigorous work. And they can't do this. I'm just repaying what was said at those hearings, and Lynn and Damon were there and would remember this as well, because you can't get access to the Big Four or the NICS second-tier firms' papers, et cetera, to look at it, carry it out. You know, you can collect lots of information in a very anonymous fashion when you do your inspections. That could then be coded in a way that nobody would know who it is from the outside. And that would become a worthwhile area for individuals to come in and do research. And, you know, so you may want to just think about that. But I think that if you thought about it that, I think you answer my first question, which is what's the end? And then how you would do this. I mean, I have no idea, reading this report, whether these are significant events or insignificant events. All I know is that I'm glad my money is in the backyard and probably not in any of these places, okay? Well, however big or however small they may be.
Thank you, Jim. Doug Anderson?
Yeah, I wanted to follow up on something Barbara had said. She stole most of my thunder, what I wanted to comment on, but I wanted to add two pieces to that. And this is getting back to, I like the report, but it doesn't answer most of my questions because it doesn't tell me the why. Why things happened. And where Barbara went through and speculated a few reasons of why these things could happen, I would actually propose think through a structure so that we can read it easier. And I in my own mind, can think of three basic reasons why you could have these happening. First of all, that the standards of the guidance weren't clear. So the people reading the standards and the guidance couldn't understand it. Could it be caused by that? Secondly, was it that the firms did not put in place the right structures and policies and practices to implement that guidance and those standards, whether it's audit methodology or selection of people or training people? And thirdly, was it just flat-out poor execution? Did people know how to do it? Did they know what they were supposed to do and they just failed to execute, or the firms had the wrong culture to encourage proper execution? Knowing which of those three make a big difference in knowing how to deal with it after the fact. And then, and that gets back into the other thing I just wanted to add. On future 4010 reports like this, I would suggest strongly that you would not issue such a report without having the root cause identified. Because throwing out there just this is all the things that went wrong without knowing why only tells half the story. So I would make an explicit part of the structure of these kind of reports that you force yourself to answer that question, why did these things happen? From what you've seen, why do you think it happened? I know as an internal auditor, we wouldn't issue a report without getting at the root cause, because that's the obvious question. You can't just report the problems. You have to report why they happened.
Galen Hansen.
Thank you, and thank you for this report and your report today. I look at it as somewhat of a report card on the profession in a way, and my comment goes back to Professor Cox's and Doug's that he just mentioned. In terms of one way to potentially improve this, I would be really interested, because it talks about deficiencies throughout this, but the deficiencies that resulted in restatements, because those are the things that directly might impact an investor's judgment. And you know, we've talked about restatements, how they can be interpreted different ways. But how many was that quantified anywhere along the road? The amounts of the numbers or the amounts thereof, the magnitude that would have been meaningful to be in the report, as far as I'm concerned.
Lynn Turner.
I think it's a pretty good report. I found the information very useful and well done. I do think providing the color commentary around it, though, like you've heard from people around the table, in essence, write it to some degree for the public so we can put some context around it next time around would improve the report. But I think the basic data and all in there is I found very useful and very good. It is, I think people do have a tendency to use it as a report card on the profession, and yet without percentages and numbers, you really don't know whether that's true or not. The problems that are cited are very significant, very concerning, but without knowing the numbers, you can't put it in proper perspective. And quite frankly, these do even get used in the academic classroom. So it'd be good for everyone to be able to see just what we're talking about. Are we talking about a small problem? Are we talking about an isolated partner that, you know, went off on his own like a lone wolf, or are we talking about systemic problems within the firm? I do note, though, when I map out what's in this report versus the deficiencies that were recently cited, I think it was the Financial Reporting Council over in the UK, that many of the deficiencies seem to be similar in nature. So it seems to be not only a deficiency here in the U.S., but globally, which may call into some question whether or not the international quality control system of these firms is really as good as what investors might think it is. So it'd be useful to think of it in that context. When I read through the individual pieces in the report, the thing that stood out the most to me that was, again, most concerning, what I mentioned earlier, was time and time and time again, you state that the auditor just looked to corroborate the number that management gave them, and that the auditor never looked to see if there were there was contrary evidence. Damon mentioned the loan reserves, and I think that's a classic example. That's certainly one where you actually state that the evidence was that the economy was going in one direction, the loan loss reserve was going in the other direction, yet the auditor just looked to corroborate what management gave them. I think the board needs to seriously look at that, because if that is what we've actually got going on in practice, then the reality is we don't really have quality audits. They just don't exist, at least in the circumstances cited. Wayne mentioned professional skepticism should deal with that. I'm long over that. We've had professional skepticism in the auditing standards for decades, and yet we've never gotten it. So we can write it as many times and say, but even yesterday, the European Union came out and said, in Europe, sufficient professional skepticism just didn't exist, and it's a problem. So I think it should be there, but it isn't. Not only here in the U.S., but in Europe. And so I think the board has to figure out how to deal with that, whether it's through enforcement or whatever. But just writing the words professional skepticism and telling people you got to be professionally skeptical isn't working, hasn't worked for decades, continues to not work today. And I think this report highlights that you got to do something about that, because I think that is key. I don't disagree with Wayne. I think it is key, but it just isn't occurring. And it's not just here in the U.S., not just a problem you're seeing, but a problem that they saw in Europe as well. And finally, I'd like to echo Damon's point. The seriousness of this foreclosure shutdown nationwide in light of the fact that 49 regulators have come out today and said they're now going to start looking at the foreclosure process and what happened and how false and misleading documents got filed with the courts and how these securitization trusts ended up without the adequate documents. Some of this, which one would have thought people were looking at files, does raise a serious question here. And I would certainly urge the board to get ahead of this issue, because if this continues to implode the way it might, that would be that would seriously call into question the integrity of some of these audits, these financial institutions altogether.
Gary Kaburek.
Thank you, Bella. And by the way, this was a very good report, and I actually really enjoy reading it. I would echo, get a couple of comments, and then I'll end with a question. I would echo the comments about having some form of context, you know, volume, was it only an audit failure, was it also a management failure, the root cause, and so on. That is absolutely important, I think, on a going forward basis. And one thing I would be expecting is when auditors are going in the last couple of years is that in all of these areas is that their client, that their management in some capacity was increasing its internal procedures, whether it's improving or enhancing credit checks, you know, for new business or whatever. So I would expect the auditors would see management itself doing more. You know, as I read the report, I mean, these areas are the areas that are going to be more likely not challenged in bad economic times. And as you go through it, whether it's impaired loans or impaired receivables or, you know, inventory you can't move and so on, I mean, it's not surprising that these would be the areas that be problematic in strong in poor economic times. I would expect your reports would do that. But in the context of thousands of audits and trillions of dollars being audited by thousands of auditors and so on, I don't find any of these subjects in here surprising that they didn't show up in at least a few cases. But my question to the staff is, was there any, I'll call it, aha moment or surprise, like, I can't believe this was in there? I mean, it makes sense loan losses and recession are going to be a challenge. But is there anything that really surprised you that you found that would surprise us that it would be on the list? And again, going back, like I say, loan losses, inventory, are not surprising that they're problems. But do you see anything that's not obvious to us that we should be aware of?
Well, I guess I'd respond by saying in our analysis, where we spend our time, we're analyzing we're assessing the risk that we see out in the marketplace as it relates to specific issuers and then as it relates to the auditors and their efforts. So we are always, because of our risk-based approach, always focusing on, you know, what we perceive to be the greatest risk. And I think you see the report here focuses on that. So I'm not sure I have a response to say that, you know, an aha moment. You know, it's a continual analysis of what we do and others within the other programs within the PCAOB, so that there's a collective knowledge sharing that helps us direct our efforts into the particular areas.
I mean, it probably goes a bit to the selection process that I referenced in terms of, you know, we select the area because we expect that there are likely problems. So when we find them, I guess, you know, kind of goes to the question people say, you know, how did the inspection go? You know, it's tough to know how to answer that. Does it mean, is it good if you had a lot of findings, or is it good if it was a good audit? It's great if it's a good audit.
Neri Buxpan.
It strikes me as maybe there's a bigger fish to fry here, and I think the issue is more broad. And what we observed is some elements of operation risk that translate to financial risk,
and at what point this financial risk is being captured and how the financial risk is being audited. I think what Damon is raising is quite important, right? When you look at, and it could also tie to your activities about fraud and other areas. But it almost goes, some of it goes to an area of, you know, how good you are as far as running your business, your core business, and how certain elements could be deficient in how well you run your business can quickly transpire into a large financial risk, and at what point you think the role of the auditors play a part and what part it should play. It was also associated with the risk factors in the 10-Ks. Some of them ties to audits, some of them ties to a greater understanding. What could be a risk factor that can play, well, itself to a massive financial debacle. So I do recognize the notion of operations. I do recognize the notion of operations also cut, for example, in the broker-dealer's audits. I think there's some scope for the board to step back and think about what is the role of an auditor for assessment of risks that are associated with operational risks, and where do you draw the line?
Damon Silvers.
So I've been thinking in the course of listening to my fellow panelists, and I have the following further observation for you all. You asked at the beginning of the conversation our thoughts about implications of the report for standards and priorities for the board. And it just dawned on me that really what bothers me about this in a way is that I don't think that the report suggests that fundamentally there is a problem with the standards that this board has enacted. I think there are some very serious issues that are kind of being forced upon you by the way that FASB has moved with respect to financial accounting standards, and we're going to discuss that later. But I don't believe that the problem here was that the auditing standards that were in place in the run-up to the financial crisis were fundamentally defective. I think they simply were not applied or followed. And so the challenge for this board is not a challenge about standards and priorities and so forth. It's a challenge about enforcement. Because ultimately, the standards are meaningless if they are not enforced. And that really is, I think, the challenge that you all face in respect of this matter. And it's not, I was heartened to hear that you're in an ongoing phase and with respect to those matters, and it's I think inappropriate for you to talk to us about the details of them, but I think it is appropriate for us to say to you that's really the challenge.
Well, thanks, Damon, and thanks everybody. I'm sorry, Denny, I didn't see one more card up there. Denny Beresford.
Just one last comment. I think a lot of people have mentioned trying to put the report in context in terms of numbers and things like that. I think another point of context would be that while this is couched in terms of the financial crisis, I think a similar report could be written almost every year with respect to findings of the inspections program. And I'm not so convinced that it would be that much different from year to year. And I think what might be interesting would be to see if a similar report had been written every year, what might stand out this particular report versus the years before. Damon mentioned, I know in a different context, years 2002 through 2010, for example. I think most of the observations in this report, I suspect, are the same kinds of observations we would find in the inspections program from almost every year from the beginning of the PCAOB to one degree or another.
Thanks, Cindy, for that comment. Thanks, Paul and Helen, for the presentation on the report. And we received, obviously, a lot of good feedback from the SAG members on the report and ways to think about it, types of reports like this going forward. And also the importance of, I think, root cause analysis has come out several times for us to make sure we contemplate carefully. And I assure you that is an important item on our agenda. With that, I think it's time for a break. We're a little bit behind schedule, but why don't we try to get back here at 3:20? Thank you.
If everyone can start taking their seats, we're going to begin the meeting. Thank you.
Well, the next subject and final subject for the day on our agenda deals with designing and implementing a system of quality control. As I mentioned this morning, the board has quality control standards and other standards that we adopted from the SEC practice section as part of our quality control interim standards as well. You heard Helen say in her comments that the findings that are in the 4D10 report do provide some evidence of needs to improve quality control systems within the firms. While additional root cause analysis is necessary, there's certainly leads you to that conclusion to a certain degree. Also, the other recurring deficiencies that we see in inspection reports raise some questions about quality controls as well. So, as firms continue to work and improve their quality controls, we're looking at our existing quality control standards and considering in what ways they could be improved to further enable improvements overall in quality controls, which are very important to the practice. So we have a discussion today that we have a briefing paper that was sent out to the SAG members and a discussion that will be led by Greg Skates and Brian Degano. So with that, Greg?
Thanks, Marty. The purpose of our final discussion today is to get your views on topics relating to the design and implementation of systems of quality control for the accounting firms. As Marty mentioned this morning, we anticipate issuing a concept release on quality controls in the second quarter of 2011. Before we get started, I'd like to first briefly review our agenda. We're going to start with a background discussion of the development of the quality control standards that were adopted by the board, followed by an overview of the board's quality control standards that we have today. And that will be followed by the a discussion of the PCLB's evaluations of the firm's systems of quality control. And after that, we plan to have a brief a Q&A session at that moment. And then following that Q&A session, Then we'll go into our discussion topics that we outlined in the briefing paper. And now I'd like to turn over to the first item, the development of the quality control standards. Doug Carmichael, the PCLB's first chief auditor, will provide some remarks about the development of the quality control standards. Doug?
Thank you, Greg. There's been an interplay throughout the development of quality control standards between those standards and peer review, or in the PCOB's structure, inspections. The process really began in August of 1972 when there was an activist chief accountant at the SEC named Sandy Burton. And as a result of a settlement of a TUI proceeding against a firm generally known as Labenthal and Horwath, there was an agreement that they would have a peer review of their practice. And at the time, there were no standards for doing that kind of review or the criteria that would be used for, and that actually raised the question of the need for quality control standards. Sandy Burton thought that there should be a panel review, and people at the AICPA, and particularly under the influence of the firms, were pushing for a firm-on-firm review, and that discussion continued for some time. In between the beginning and the end of that discussion, a very important factor came along, and that was the equity funding fraud. Equity funding became known to the public. The inklings came out in March 1973, and by April of 1973, it was clear that there was a huge fraud. And it's hard, given the number that we've experienced since that time, to get some sense of what it was like. But the accounting profession clearly believed that the public fallout from that fraud had severely eroded confidence in the accounting profession. And when there were congressional hearings, the Moss-Metcalf hearings, Congressman Moss described it as a great scandal that had shaken the country. And that was probably not too much of an exaggeration. The SEC, through its chairman, Brad Cook, summoned all the people involved, and Equity Funding was an insurance company and a broker-dealer. So it was insurance regulation, broker-dealer regulation. It was a public company. It was audited by different firms. But the major problem was that a relatively large firm had acquired a very small firm that was the Equity Funding auditor and really hadn't changed the audit team and in some people's estimation had not supervised the audit in that sense properly. So by the time the Elementhal and Horwath review was agreed on, which was October 1973, it was agreed that the AICPA would appoint a panel to do the review. And again, it pointed to the need for quality control standards, the criteria to use in doing that kind of review. So the Auditing Standards Board did have a project underway, and it was initially titled Project on Supervision. And these events made it clear that there were really two broad aspects of supervision. One was the supervision during an individual audit, and the other was the supervision by a firm of its audits. So a task force was appointed. The task force chairman was Tom Holton. He was a partner at what was then called Pete Marwick, now KPMG. And he had been a past chairman of the Auditing Standards Committee, and in addition to his competence, was appointed to the task because of his can-do attitude. He had a way of just getting things done. So he got the quality control standards done. There were 9 elements of quality control then. We have fewer today, but that's mainly just a consolidation of some of the 9. The AICPA proceeded to try to put together a voluntary peer review program. There were a lot of disputes about that. Pete Marwick volunteered to have the first peer review and believed that a firm-on-firm review was appropriate, and they engaged Lloyd Haskins and Sells to do the review. Then there was a dispute about whether the results of the peer review could be made public under the voluntary quality review program. Some firms were concerned that a firm that successfully passed a review would be viewed as a better, higher quality firm than one that hadn't passed. And so there was objection to making the results public. There was a special committee formed, and although the quality control standards were there, it wasn't until 1977, as indicated on the slide, that the AICPA proposed and developed a division for firms with an SEC practice section and a small company practice section that had a requirement for a peer review. Up through that time, the quality control standards had been issued by the Auditing Standards Committee. A separate peer review committee was set up that was in charge of developing the quality control standards for a firm and the standards for how you did a peer review. And ultimately, their first standard, the Statement on Standards for Quality Control, number one, was issued in November of 1979, superseding SAS number 4, and a brief statement on auditing standards was put in the authoritative standards, which we still have today, that pointed out that a firm should develop its quality control standards. So that's a brief history. Stepping back from that, the things that I would observe are that at least in the initial development through where we are today, the primary focus in developing the quality control standards was to provide criteria that would inspire user confidence. In other words, the viewpoint was more the confidence that would be inspired in the investing public by knowing that there were quality control standards and that there was some mechanism for firms adhering to them had been more important than developing than helping firms to develop the standards. In other words, firms didn't necessarily believe that they needed help in figuring out what the quality control measures would be. The development of standards coupled with the peer review was designed to inspire investor confidence. I was also struck by the fact that the whole process got started and was really pushed by regulatory and disciplinary pressure. In other words, it wasn't so much internally generated as pushed from those outside factors. Those are the significant things. I think the other thing I noticed about the standards was that from the very beginning, they had a high degree of scalability built into them, since they necessarily pertain to firms of dramatically different size and reach, and that certainly is one of the problems in developing quality control standards is maintaining that scalability, because it's obviously an area where the cliche of one size does not fit all certainly applies.
Thank you, Doug. Thank you. I appreciate those remarks as we get started this afternoon for this final discussion. I'd now like to turn our discussion over to Brian Degano, Associate Chief Auditor, who's going to give an overview of our quality control standards. Brian?
Thanks, Greg. As you can see on the slide, our current quality control standards include QC20, QC30, and QC40, and there's also certain requirements from the SEC practice section that Doug had mentioned that have also been adopted by the board. And we'd like to give a brief overview of each of those standards. Next slide. QC Section 20 provides most of the overall guidance on designing and implementing a system of quality control. It defines a system of quality control, it outlines the elements of quality control, and provides guidance on the administration of a quality control system. QC 20 defines a system of quality control as a process to provide a firm with reasonable assurance that its personnel comply with applicable professional standards and the firm's standards of quality. A firm's system of quality control, according to QC 20, encompasses the firm's organizational structure and the policies adopted and procedures established to provide reasonable assurance of complying with professional standards. And as Doug had mentioned, the standards are very much written to be scalable for all different sizes of firms. And QC 20 notes that the nature, extent, and formality of a firm's quality control policies and procedures should be appropriately comprehensive and suitably designed in relation to factors such as the firm's size, the number of its offices, the degree of authority allowed its personnel and its offices, the knowledge and experience of its personnel, and the nature and complexity of the firm's practice. QC 20 also notes that a system of quality control should provide a firm with reasonable assurance that the segments of the firm's engagements that are performed by its foreign offices or by its domestic or foreign affiliates are performed in accordance with professional standards. And as shown as this on the slide, QC 20 requires that 5 specific elements be encompassed in a firm's system of quality control and its policies and procedures. The first element is independence, integrity, and objectivity. And firms need to establish policies and procedures to obtain reasonable assurance that its personnel maintain independence, perform all professional responsibilities with integrity and objectivity. Another element required by QC 20 is personnel management. And a firm needs to have quality control policies and procedures that provide the firm with reasonable assurance that the people that the firm hires possess the appropriate characteristics to enable them to perform competently. The firm assigns work to people having the degree of technical training and proficiency required in the circumstances. Partners and staff participate in general and industry-specific continuing professional education and other professional development activities to enable them to fulfill their responsibilities assigned to them and to satisfy applicable continuing professional education requirements, and that the personnel selected for advancement have the qualifications necessary for fulfillment of the responsibilities that they will be called on to assume. Another element that's required to be in a system of quality control is quality control policies and procedures regarding the acceptance and continuance of client relationships and engagements. And a firm is required to establish policies and procedures for deciding whether to accept or continue a client relationship and whether to perform a specific engagement for that client. And those policies and procedures need to provide reasonable assurance that the firm undertakes only those engagements that the firm can reasonably expect to be completed with professional competence and that the firm appropriately considers the risks associated with providing professional services in particular circumstances. Another element required by QC 20 is engagement performance, and a firm needs to establish quality control policies and procedures to provide the firm with reasonable assurance that the work performed by its engagement personnel meets applicable professional standards, regulatory requirements, and the firm's standards of quality. Those policies and procedures encompass all phases of the design and execution of the audit engagement and include planning, performing, supervising, reviewing, documenting, and communicating the results of each audit engagement. Those policies and procedures also should include policies and procedures to provide reasonable assurance that the firm's partners and staff refer to authoritative literature or other sources and consult on a timely basis with individuals who have the appropriate levels of knowledge, competence, judgment, and authority. The last element that QC 20 requires firms to include in their systems of quality control is monitoring procedures. And a firm needs to establish policies and procedures to provide the firm with reasonable assurance that the policies and procedures established by the firm for each of the other elements of quality control have been suitably designed and are being effectively applied. Monitoring involves an ongoing consideration and evaluation of the relevance and adequacy of the firm's policies and procedures, the appropriateness of the firm's guidance and practice alerts, effectiveness of professional development activities, and the compliance with the firm's policies and procedures by its personnel. And we'll talk a little bit more about monitoring when we get into QC 30, which gives more advice on monitoring. QC 20 also describes how these elements are interrelated. It notes, through examples, that maintaining integrity, objectivity, and independence requires a continuing assessment of client relationships. It also notes that quality control policies and procedures regarding personnel management, such as hiring and advancement and assignment of the firm's personnel to engagements, can impact policies and procedures developed to address the element of engagement performance. QC 20 also gives guidance on the administration of a system of quality control and notes that to provide reasonable assurance that the firm's quality control system achieves its objectives, appropriate consideration needs to be given to the assignment of quality control responsibilities within the firm, the means by which quality control policies and procedures have been communicated, and the extent to which the policies and procedures and the compliance with those policies and procedures need to be documented. Next slide. QC Section 30 provides additional guidance to firms on how to implement the monitoring element of a quality control system, and it notes that monitoring procedures taken as a whole need to enable the firm to obtain reasonable assurance that its system of quality control is effective. The firm's monitoring procedures could include, for example, the analysis and assessment of items such as new professional pronouncements, the results of its independence policies and procedures, a review of continuing professional education and other development activities undertaken by firm personnel, and decisions related to acceptance and continuance of client relationships and engagements. A firm's monitoring procedures may also include internal inspection procedures. A firm's internal inspection procedures should evaluate the adequacy of a firm's quality control policies and procedures, a firm personnel's understanding of those policies and procedures, and the extent of the firm's compliance with its own quality control policies and procedures. The extent of inspection procedures depends in part on the existence and effectiveness of other monitoring procedures. Factors to be considered include, among other things, the nature, complexity, and diversity of the risks associated with the firm's practice, and the results of recent practice reviews and previous inspection procedures. The adequacy of and compliance with a firm's system of quality control can be evaluated by performing such inspection procedures as reviewing engagement working papers, reports, and clients' financial statements, summarizing findings from inspection procedures, and considering the root causes of findings that indicate improvements are needed, and determining corrective actions that need to be taken or improvements that need to be made with specific engagements reviewed or the firm's quality control policies and procedures. QC 30 also recognizes that in small firms with a limited number of management-level individuals, monitoring procedures may need to be performed by some of the same individuals who are responsible for the compliance with the firm's quality control policies and procedures, and provides some guidance on this matter. QC 40 provides additional guidance on the element of personal management in relation to engagement partners. And it notes that a firm's quality control policies and procedures should be designed to provide reasonable assurance that an audit engagement partner possesses the appropriate competencies in light of their significant responsibilities in planning and performing an audit. QC 40 defines competencies as the knowledge, skills, and abilities that enable an engagement partner to be qualified to perform an audit engagement. And QC 40 also notes that a firm is expected to identify those competencies that are necessary in the individual circumstances. And as noted on the slide, QC 40 includes several examples of competencies that a firm's quality control policies and procedures should address. So, for example, an engagement partner should possess an understanding of the firm's quality control systems and the code of professional conduct. An engagement partner should possess an understanding of how to perform an audit, including performance supervision and reporting aspects of an audit engagement. The engagement partner should have technical proficiency, familiarity with the industry in which they're working. Their skills should also include professional judgment and an understanding of information technology systems that may be used by the firm under audit. And with that, I'll turn it back over to Greg for the remainder of the discussion.
Okay. Thank you, Brian. The last item, in addition to QC sections 20, 30, and 40, the board also adopted as part of its interim quality control standards, certain membership requirements from the SEC practice section. Those are outlined on the slide. There are actually six, and I'll talk about the sixth one in just a minute, but let's briefly go over those first five requirements from the SEC practice section. Also, I might mention that as Marty noted this morning in the standard setting, look at the standard setting agenda, these SEC PS requirements are applicable to only those firms that were members of the SEC practice section as of April of 2003. The first bullet there has to do with the firm personnel. It requires that all professionals in the firm residing in the U.S. participate in a minimum number of continuing professional education hours. It's at least 20 hours in every year and at least 120 hours every 3 years. This is somewhat similar to some of the state requirements under the state boards of accountancy. And the state boards in this country oftentimes have more stringent requirements. The second one has to do with requires the firms to communicate through a written statement to all professional personnel the broad principles that influence the firm's quality control and operating policies and procedures on matters related to the recommendation and approval of accounting principles, present and potential client relationships, and the types of services provided, and inform professional firm personnel periodically that compliance with those principles is mandatory. There's an illustrative written statement is a part of the appendix to this this particular requirement. The third requirement has to do with a notification to the commission when the firm has resigned. When the member firm has been the auditor for an SEC registrant and has resigned or declined to stand for re-election or has been dismissed, then the firm must report that fact that the client audit relationship has ceased in writing to the SEC, to the former SEC client, also with a copy of the letter going to the Office of the Chief Accountant at the SEC. On the fourth bullet, for these member firms that are associated with international firms or international associations of firms, then that firm is to certain policies and procedures are to be adopted by the international organization or individual foreign associated firm that are consistent with the objectives. And these objectives are set out in what
we're
commonly referred to.
We're sorry. Your conference is ending now. Please hang up.
Does that mean I'm supposed to quit?
you're stuck. Keep going.
These objectives are set forth in what we commonly refer to as Appendix K. The appendix K includes the filing review requirements as well as internal inspection procedures as well as other matters. We discussed the Appendix K in our SAG meeting in October of 2007. The last item, the fifth bullet there, requires firms to ensure that the member firm has policies and procedures in place to comply with the applicable, all applicable independence requirements. As I mentioned earlier, there was a sixth requirement, and that was a requirement we commonly referred to as Appendix E, requiring the concurring a concurring review requirement. That requirement was superseded by auditing standard number 7, entitled Engagement Quality Review. That was adopted by the board in July of 2009 and approved by the SEC in December of 2009, is now applicable to all registered firms. That concludes our remarks and overview on the quality control standards, and now I'd like to turn our discussion over to Walt Miles, a Deputy Director in Inspections, who will provide an overview of the PCAOB evaluations of firms' systems of quality control. Walt?
Okay. Thanks, Greg. I'll just spend a few minutes to talk about it at a fairly high level, our inspection processes related to the quality control systems of quality control at the firms. I think we'll have some time at the end of this, a fair amount of time, that people can ask more specific questions if you have. But in general, our process, you know, as I think Doug mentioned and Brian mentioned, that, you know, the quality control standards are scalable by necessity. Obviously, a small firm is very different than a large firm, and the standards set out a variety of things to consider when you're designing a system of quality controls. And in the same sense, our inspection processes vary. Depending on the type of firm that we're looking at, of course. We've listed on this slide various what we think of as functional areas of quality control. I think Doug also mentioned that, you know, there's been, over time, there's been the elements of quality control have kind of changed. There's various ways you can group the things that you need to consider and the areas that you need to look at. For us, we think of these as kind of the traditional functional areas that we look at. And we design inspection procedures at each inspection to address each of these various areas. Also, I think it's no surprise to anybody here, but to talk about how we go about assessing the system of quality controls and where we get the information that we use to evaluate a firm's quality control system, the bulk of our evidence and the bulk of our information about the operation of the control comes from looking at engagement performance. That's when we look at each of the individual audits that are performed and evaluate the extent to which they comply with standards. So what we find there, you know, similar to what was in the 4010 that was talked about earlier, is we find a range of practice and we find a number of instances in firms where there's not compliance with standards that causes us to believe that in some cases they're so significant that they can't support the opinion on an individual engagement. So the issues are identified there, and those are in the quality control standards set out that a firm, of course, has to have a sufficient system of quality controls to provide reasonable assurance that their personnel comply with the standards. So these engagement-specific issues, to the extent that they're pervasive, are indicative of potential problems or defects in a system of quality controls. But, of course, the difficulty you have there is that it's not real clear in many cases what it is about the system of quality controls that's defective. You know that there's instances of there's problematic audits, but it's not exactly clear what control process is defective. And that gets back to the discussion, I think, that's come up a number of times today about the root cause analysis and trying to figure out why are things occurring and what is it that a firm needs to change about their system of quality controls to address those. I'll come back to talk a little bit more about root cause analysis and some of the things that we're looking at, you know, some of the efforts that we undertake at the largest firms particularly to look at the monitoring of audit quality and the response to audit quality issues. But so in addition to the engagement performance issues that we identify, we perform specific tests of the outputs of the control system. And that, I think, has been, you know, traditionally, that's where our focus had been, is looking at, you know, identifying when controls failed. Look at the output, and did something occur that you would expect the control process to have identified. Increasingly, though, particularly in the largest firms, we're spending more time looking at the design and operation of the controls themselves. and looking at the extent to which those the controls are designed in a comprehensive way, that there's a reasonable expectation that they would be effective. Not just testing for the output of the things that, that may have got through the controls, but looking much more closely at the controls themselves. And this is a fairly comprehensive process at the large firms. We're increasingly dedicating more inspection resources to this area. We have at the largest firms, we have teams of inspectors that focus on this pretty much throughout the year and perform various testing. And we've kind of renamed more recently our processes in this area. We call it looking at the significant management and monitoring process of the firms is kind of the FMM process to kind of identify that aspect of what we're doing. Am I supposed to point this at something? A little more detail about our kind of our process, the inspection process. In the largest firms, what we do is obviously each year we find things that we believe are defects in a firm's system of quality controls, and those things have to be followed up on. And so we design specific inspection procedures to look at those areas and to evaluate the extent to which firms have taken remedial actions in the specific issues that we've identified. But of course, kind of stepping back a minute, the largest firms, of course, it's a pretty comprehensive system of management processes and controls that are interrelated in ways that it's in any one inspection cycle, it's not possible for us to fully evaluate all of the control processes at the detail that we might like to. But what we try to do is to follow up on the issues that we've identified in the past, test those, understand the extent to which remediation has occurred. We understand the extent to which changes have occurred in significant processes and follow up on those, understand those. And then increasingly, in more recent years, we perform what we call horizontal inspection activities. And so in those cases, what we'll do is we'll take specific areas of a quality control process, we'll develop more detailed scoping documents that think about what we want to look at in more detail, and we look at the same issues and same processes at a number of firms at the same time. There's a number of benefits to that, I think some of which are probably relatively obvious, but it gives us an understanding of the industry and not just one firm. It lets us understand the range of practice and to think about the implications of that range of practice, and then it helps us determine, what it is that's defective in individual firms and what needs to be done and called out in our reporting process. So I think I thought maybe what I would do is spend a little more time in one specific area. Obviously, of the functional quality control areas that I talked about earlier, there's lots of different things that we do in different areas. But one of the things that we've spent an increasing amount of time on in recent years is kind of the comprehensive processes, the firm's monitoring processes for monitoring and responding to audit quality. I think traditionally, people think of the internal inspection program. That's the key process that a firm uses to understand the deficiencies that exist in a practice, and that's certainly a key process and a key element of a control process. But there's a wider variety of things I think that need to be considered in a firm. There's the internal inspection process is looking at engagements and reviewing those on some kind of a cycle to understand issues. But there's also other things in a firm that are indicative of audit quality deficiencies. There's restatements, there's litigation, there's PCOB findings, peer review findings. There's a bunch of different things that are indicative, or that may be indicative, of problems with quality in a firm. And so our inspection processes, look to see the extent to which a firm, and we look at the individual processes, so we look at the internal inspection program itself, and increasingly we spent more time in addition to doing some testing of engagements that internal inspections have looked at to see whether we agree with the findings that the internal inspectors found and see if there's issues that they didn't identify, we also look to see, the design of the inspection program itself. Look to see, how are they staffed? How is an internal inspection program staffed? Does it have appropriate dedication of resources at senior levels? Do they spend enough time on audits when they're looking at them? Is the scope of what they're looking at, is it sufficient? Doing internal inspections, it's not as if that isn't something that we don't have a little experience with ourselves. We're in the same business. We've learned over time that to really understand complex issues in some of the biggest audits, it takes a fair amount of time and dedication of resources to fully deal with the more complex issues. So we look at the extent to which the firm's programs allow for that and deal with those issues. So we look at the individual processes, like the internal inspection program. We look at the firm's processes to what do they do around restatements to understand the extent of audit deficiencies. Are the processes, you know, primarily focused at understanding accounting issues in a restatement and dealing with the accounting issue, or are they also focused on understanding what auditing issue occurred as well to that didn't detect the accounting issue in the first instance? So then we look to see, you know, what the processes that the firms have, are each of these processes in a siloed nature, or are the processes of the firm to pull all those together and think about the extent to which those deficiencies might be more indicative of pervasive issues that are not just isolated in individual engagement performance, but are indicative of problems with the system of quality controls. And then, once there's an understanding of the issues, then we get focused on the extent to which the firms have processes for understanding root causes. And I think this is an area that we've increasingly focused on over the last couple of years. Not only are we, as the PCOB, do we need to understand better the root causes of the things that we identify, but it's a critical element of the firm's quality control processes that they themselves undertake sufficient efforts to understand the root causes. And that's, I think, you know, that area in particular, there's a lot of, you know, probably debate or question about how best to perform root cause analysis. The extent of resources that should be dedicated to that and how to go about doing it. The one thing that I don't think there's any debate about, though, is that it's very difficult to do, and it's not easy to figure out what is the root cause. And in some cases, it may not be possible on an individual engagement to really know with any level of certainty what the root cause is. But I think we also all agreed, too, that the probability of success of a remedial action is enhanced significantly to the extent that you have some understanding about why it occurred. And in many cases, you know, what you have to do, what a system of quality control will need to do is it needs to make informed judgments about why those things occurred and then take remedial actions that are responsive to that. Of course, the other important part is once you look at it, how the firms deal with these issues, is look at the extent to which once they've kind of understood the issues and why they might have occurred, to look at the linkage to the corrective action. You know, is there a systematic process for ensuring that the corrective action that is taken is the people that understand best why the issue occurred are looking at the remedial action and saying, yeah, that is dealing with the issue and why we think it occurred, not just the remedial action that's being undertaken is in the neighborhood, I guess, or somewhat related to the issue. But making an evaluation and ensuring that there is a linkage with the corrective action to the cause of the issue. And then finally, the last thing in that area that I'll mention is the importance of kind of the follow-up monitoring procedures. Once you know you have an issue and you believe that the issue is somewhat pervasive and you've taken remedial action, it's important in a healthy quality control process to design additional procedures, detect procedures to determine whether that the actions you took were effective or not. And so we looked at the extent to which firms have developed, either through the internal inspection process or through other control processes to follow up on the issue to determine, make a conclusion about whether the remedial actions were appropriate. I think with that, I'll turn it back to you, Greg.
I'd now like to open the floor up for any questions or comments on our this background session on our standards and on the PCOB evaluation process of the firm's quality controls. Galen Hansen.
Thank you, and thanks for that great presentation. That's great background, some of which I wasn't familiar with. Let me just say a couple things about peer review and state boards, since that was what was mentioned. Peer review is now required in almost every state, I think, except for one. And mandatory peer review is required in the vast majority of those states. And one of the things that I think is critical to state boards and to NASBA in particular is having some sort of regulatory oversight. So there's a lot of effort that has gone on in this area in the last few years. We really don't even actually mention it as peer review anymore. We call it compliance assurance. And so I think this is an area that we're really working on at state boards to try to improve. And the significance of mandatory peer review in the small firm world is there were actually firms that would intentionally not belong to the AICPA, to professional membership organizations such as state societies, so that they could avoid having to go through a peer review process. And I understand that a majority of those are not involved in with auditing of public companies. Regardless, there were probably a few of those. Hence, they got around this requirement with the PCOB and the SEC because they were not a member of the SEC practice section back at the time that the interim standards were adopted. As far as the QC standards, and I've gone through the current AICPA standard number 7 that came into effect about a year ago, I think it's a pretty good starting point for discussion of this subject. My only issue with it is its strength is also its weakness, and that's it's sort of an open source document and scalable, and it has all of these different elements, but there's not a lot of mandatory to it. Like you have to have an inspection, or there has to be so many hours of CPE. And surprisingly enough, I mean, an auditor it can be involved in the audit of a public company, but be taking tax courses and CPE. So, you know, it seems to me that the flexibility of this needs to be looked at. As far as inspection, CPE, and independence, something as simple as an independence audit. Now, I understand that's required on the larger firms that are auditing more than 500 clients, but it seems to me that every firm should be going through an independence audit with their partners and audit partners and managers every single year. So there's some of the things that I think would be relevance, governance, and tone at the top, and so on. And compensation and promotion of individuals. I think that it should be more than just a focus on scalability. I believe that there should be some mandatory elements.
Thank you, Galen, for those remarks. Wayne Collins?
It seems that the inspection staff would be privy to a wealth of information about practices at the firms from a quality control aspect. Has the board staff given consideration to issuing kind of a 40-10 report on best practices that other firms could look at to shore up their own quality controls to the extent necessary in the circumstances?
I guess I'll respond, and then the other members of the board members can respond if they'd like. I mean, I think there's been some discussion about that there is a fair amount of information that we're collecting over time to understand how firms' quality control systems work, and we certainly use that in that understanding as a background in our evaluation of individual firms, and when we're discussing with firms about the deficiencies that we observe, that informs our basis for those deficiencies. And so I guess what I would say, and others could respond, I think that it's a possibility. It just hasn't happened yet.
I might chime in just a little bit in connection with our formulation of a concept release on quality controls, which we mentioned we plan for the second quarter of next year. In addition to getting input from the SAG and this discussion today, obviously we're doing a lot of other work, spending time with inspections about what they're seeing in quality control systems, where they're working, where they're not working, et cetera, the quality of the root cause and the effectiveness of root cause analyses at firms and so on and so forth. I think that should lead us to concepts and discussion in the concept release, which would be asking questions of others about, would you think this would be an appropriate way to go forward with respect to potentially enhancing the quality control systems? And I think the basis for some of those thoughts would be best practices, if you will, that we'd observe or discuss together. So if we didn't do that otherwise, I think it would come out to a large degree in a concept release.
Kevin Raleigh?
Yeah, Greg, I was just reading through the paper. I was troubled by
and confused by one statement. So let me just read it to you on the top of page 5. The PCAOB has pressed firms to take more significant steps to address what may be deeply rooted management and cultural impediments to audit quality. So that's a very troublesome statement. I don't personally believe it's operative relative to the profession, but holy smokes, if you believe that, I'm not so sure putting together 10,000 pages worth of quality control guidance is going to address this type of issue. So I would just appreciate some clarification on that statement.
Greg will probably want to respond to some extent. I mean, I can talk from an inspections perspective, I guess, as kind of to respond to that issue. What exactly is meant in the paper? Greg may want to elaborate on that. But I mean, I think the thing is that there are instances, individual engagement instances, where I think it's when you look at the root cause and try to determine why things happened, you might get to a range of conclusions, some of which could be very troubling, just like you mentioned. Now, the extent to which that's a pervasive issue in a firm or in an industry, and if that is the issue that has to be addressed, obviously addressing that issue is a very significant thing and probably the most significant thing that you can deal with in a firm. I don't think, and I don't know what was meant exactly in the paper, but I don't think that statement in the paper is meant to imply that we believe that is the issue in firms in general, and that is the primary issue that firms are dealing with. Greg, you may want to say something, or Marty.
Yeah, Kevin, that line is actually from the 2009 annual report, as it's footnoted. It's not meant to be indicative of the profession as a whole. It's a line that just talks about how the board has tried to go out and do inspections and some of the things that it's been doing. It's not directed to the profession as a whole at all. It's just saying that, you know, in response to successful inspections, it's for individual firms that might have needed extra work. So it's not meant to cast a shadow on everybody.
I got to tell you, it definitely casts a shadow. I don't mean to sound defensive, but that type of statement is really dangerous. And to the extent that it's out there in the paper, and if it's not what you specifically thought it was going to mean, I can only tell you as a reader, I took a look at that and said, holy smokes, folks, if this is your view, I think we're talking about the wrong issue. This is not going to be a quality control issue. This is a much broader issue facing the profession. And Ron, I hear you, but that's not the language that was in the 2009 annual report, at least as I tried to connect the dots.
All right. Thank you, Kevin. Barbara Roper?
Yeah, I mean, I actually had exactly the opposite response to that language, because it seems to me that it reflects a realization on the part of the board that not every problem can be addressed just by a new standard, that there's a range, I mean, that certainly there should be a range of remedies. It's very difficult for me sitting in this position to know what part of this problem we solve through standards, what part of this problem we solve through sort of tougher remediation requirements, what part of this problem we solve through enforcement actions. But the report suggests to me that there's a role for all three of those, and I assume that the board is engaged in all three of those activities. And, you know, an acknowledgement there that in some cases the problem is not just a problem with the standard, but a problem with more deep-seated cultural impediments in the firms to getting this stuff right, I think is actually a healthy view for the board to keep as part of its broad spectrum of analysis of issues at the firms.
Yeah, maybe I should just say, I'm not sure, Kevin, I understand what your problem with the statement is. I think it is an accurate statement of findings in the QC part, the non-public part of certain inspection reports. I think this has already been said. That's not meant to be a statement about every firm that we've inspected or a pervasive statement about firm quality controls, but it's an accurate statement about certain situations that we've looked at where we feel there are deeply rooted management and cultural impediments to audit quality. So I don't find anything misleading about that statement.
And Dan, and again, forgive me, it's just my confusion that in the context of reading the paper, I thought it was taking a look at profession issues across the board, not specific to what your findings might have been with one particular inspection.
Well, I think it applies to more than one, but it's not meant to be a broad statement necessarily about firms everywhere. But there certainly are, I would say, important, significant situations where we've made that finding and we've applied that kind of pressure.
Lynn Turner.
I can certainly understand why the PCAOB would be making that statement, and given some circumstances that have popped up in recent years. In one year, we had the Japanese regulator shut down an entire firm in Japan. We've had serious problems raised with respect to a firm in India. And a year ago, we had the regulators raid the offices of a firm in Hong Kong over issues of integrity. So it's certainly outside the U.S., it's certainly consistent with what we've actually seen occurring, and probably raises the issue of, are the quality control systems what they need to be? And perhaps it's more serious than just quality control, to the point that Kevin is making. As I look through the paper and the questions you raised in the paper, I think it does cause you to go back and rethink this whole issue of quality control and how we've thought about it in the profession ever since the first systems were put in place in the early 70s, as Doug described. I think more recently, we have what has been happening with compliance to improve controls in the 40 Act companies, and how the SEC has approached that with respect to compliance inspections and compliance reports and establishing accountability for those systems. And now we certainly have, with respect to the credit rating agencies, a new system going in there, both of which have some superior components to them that we don't have in the auditing profession, especially with the notion of a chief compliance officer who has to oversee the entire compliance program and who has to report up through an independent source to the top and a governance mechanism established over that, and what will be in essence a public compliance inspection report. And I think that's something that certainly needs to be considered here in the context of quality control. I think when you look at the components of quality control, a piece that I think is lacking there is a specific item that gets into the issue of how do you establish accountability and responsibility for this and bring that forward in the context of transparency. I know when the ISO rules originally went in for manufacturing people, everyone went in and adopted those rules and put systems in place, but what we found in manufacturing companies was that people put a lot of emphasis on process, and everyone had processes, but the defect rate never went down. And so I think you have to look to more than just processes. You have to look at the actual outcome of the process and see if it's actually getting the defect rate down to what it, what it's supposed to be. And hopefully here we have we'll never get to zero defect rate on audits, but I would certainly hope that that's our goal and objective, even though we might not change it. But I do think we have to look well beyond just process here, and we have to start looking at not only how they've been designed, but is the design not only, and are we testing not only what it is, but are we testing what it should be, especially as the markets and economic conditions change? Are we changing that system? And that includes in the international process as we become more global and international, and the international audits become a much more important piece. Do we have the right systems? Do we have accountability? Do we have someone, in essence, at the top of these big firms as well as the smaller firms that are ultimately responsible in that quality, for that quality control system, not only here, but wherever that audit reaches around the globe? And that's not only for the big four. That's a serious question for these affiliates of some of the smaller firms, where they're a kind of a consortium of groups, and you may have a McGladrey here, you may have an affiliate someplace else, but in that case, who is really responsible, and who can the PCLB really hold accountable? If there's someone to be held accountable because the system isn't working, who do you point to? And unfortunately, we've seen the firms where everyone points the finger at one another, and it's not me, and I think that has to be considered in this context of quality control as well.
Thank you, Lynn. Bill Gradison?
I'd like to comment on the question of cultural factors. And what I want to offer is purely personal observation and truly just an hypothesis. But it is based upon reading maybe 1,000 inspection reports over the last 8 years, thinking about it. I think there is a cultural problem in many instances, which goes to the question of what does it mean to be a professional. I think that many professionals are accustomed, by the time they become the partner of a law firm or get their medical degree or get their become partner of a big very large accounting firm, to feel that they have the experience and the know-how to operate with a high degree of independence. And truly don't expect to have people looking over their shoulder. I worked for a law firm. I don't remember anybody in the front office taking a look at the things I was sending out to clients. Typical physician, they're seeing more of that now, but I don't think that in the small groups of physicians, at least, that they're accustomed to that kind of review at all. What I don't know is whether there's any, first, whether there's anything to what I'm suggesting, and because if there is, we might detect some difference between newer partners and those who have been around for a while, because the newer ones are coming into a regulatory environment that's been around for 8 years now, whereas others may have grown up in a period when there was less centralization of oversight within the firm itself. Forget us, within the firm itself. I think at times that in terms of best practice, as again just my observation, that the firms that seem to be doing the best, and they're not all equal, that seem to me to be doing the best in terms of quality controls are the ones that have a significantly higher degree of centralization in these areas than others. I can't prove that, but I wouldn't quickly dismiss the possibility that cultural factors were of significance.
Thank you, Bill. Jeff Mahoney?
Thank you. I just note there's maybe somewhat similar language in the audit inspection unit report of the UK Professional Oversight Board and their July 21st report. Under audit quality major firms, they state, quote, notwithstanding the quality of firms' policies and procedures, the number of audits assessed as requiring significant improvement at major firms is too high. Firms are therefore not always consistently applying their policies and procedures on all aspects of individual audits. It goes on to say, policies and procedures, however, can only go so far in supporting and encouraging desirable behaviors to deliver audit quality. While firms are willing to change these and to provide additional training to staff, such actions will be insufficient without effective behavioral change, which is more difficult to achieve. So it seems like maybe some of that language is somewhat analogous to the language you have in your paper.
I think it is, Jeff, and I think it's a good point. I appreciate that that input. We had a meeting just about a month ago or so here, and that meeting was to discuss communications with audit committees, and it was a very strong sentiment of the audit committee members who were at that meeting that one of the most important factors driving behavior in the organizations of which they were audit committee chairs in many cases was the culture of that organization. And equally important, and maybe even more important, the comment they made was the tone at the top was maybe one of the most important things that they felt was necessary to understand if they were going to understand the controls within the organization. I think that goes to this point as well. Understanding the culture of firms is very important, and what drives that culture, whether it's driven towards audit quality, driven towards profitability, whatever the major factors are in the culture, I think are critical, and they vary from firm to firm. But that culture can affect audit quality. I also have a question almost for you, Walt, and that is, audit committee members said that they were able to observe the tone at the top and communicate to the CEO and others about the tone, and that was critical. They asked the external auditors about the tone at the top, and they felt that was one of the most important communications that they got from the external auditors so they could assess tone at the top to ensure that the organization was behaving correctly and setting the right course. As you look at firms, where does top management of the firms hear about the tone of the top? They don't have the equivalent of an audit committee necessarily or a board that's looking at that or hearing from external auditors. Are we the only ones who are communicating about the tone at the top to an organization, or do the firms themselves have other ways to assess their own tone at the top, since everybody, I think, feels that's so important in other types of organizations and probably in accounting firms as well?
Oh, that's a good question, Marty. I guess the way I respond in a couple ways, I guess. One, I think assessing tone at the top is a difficult effort for anyone to do, and so I think you know, we look at it in a variety of ways that we get information about the tone at the top, and it's a lot of the things that have been mentioned here, and Lynn mentioned some of them, accountability and the kind of information that firms themselves, the way they structure themselves to get information about quality incidents and the execution of engagements to the right people within the firm, and the way that they respond to those, and the extent to which they've implemented a proactive, what I think of as a proactive management and control infrastructure to get the right information to the right people within the firm to understand not only engagement performance, but to understand the culture within the firm and how people are acting. So I think the firm's own processes themselves, to a variety of ways, they have designed information flows to get that information to the right people, and they've set up management structures. They don't have the same governance structure that you would in, say, a listed entity or something like that, but they have some of those kind of things. I think it varies, though, and I think it varies. Another thing that was mentioned by someone earlier, I guess Bill discussed it, but the extent to which firms operated in a distributed fashion in which they've allocated responsibility and accountability in a more granular way, I'm not so sure that those firms necessarily have as good a processes about understanding the culture that exists and the extent to which it's not, and the extent to which the culture is consistent even. And so I'm not sure if that answers your question, but I think there's a variety of ways. We ourselves at inspections, we look at tone at the top from a number of different ways. Like I said, the actual performance of engagements, the extent to which how firms respond to issues when they've identified them, the extent to which firms have, you know, treat their control infrastructure as what I would call, you know, something more than a compliance exercise. It's a proactive process to understand when things are occurring and understand when the culture might be shifting or changing inappropriately and incentives might be getting out of line. But it varies between the firms.
Well, I was agreeing with Barbara's comment that she made earlier and Jeff's reading of comments that came out of the UK that we can establish all the procedures we want, and as we think about our concept release and what we're doing going forward, but clearly the culture of the organization and the tone at the top are critical elements that will make the quality controls be effective or not, in my view. So the extent to which firms have the ability to assess those things themselves becomes critically important also. Jim Schnur?
Thanks, Marty. Just a couple of points I'd like to make. First of all, maybe to follow up on Kevin's point. I mean, there's other language in this paper that implies that the firms need to be motivated to promote audit quality or to minimize incentives to not promote audit quality. And I take exception to that point for a number of reasons. First of all, at least in the U.S., the legal environment here causes me to go home every night and think about doing the right thing. I have a substantial amount of my net worth tied up in the firm, in the form of my capital, and my retirement, which I'm pretty close to. I don't know a better motivation than essentially losing your financial wherewithal to do the right thing. And the loss of a single client is not going to cause the firm to go out of business. As a firm, we spend hundreds of millions of dollars a year with respect to investigations and lawsuits, etc. So again, that pales comparison to just about any fee we get from a single client. So I think in the context of looking at this issue, it's important to put into context that an individual is motivated to do the right thing. And the fact that there are audit deficiencies, in no way, I believe, you know, with few exceptions, are it's done intentionally. We talked today about the number of professional standards that require judgment. In terms of judgment, different people have different views, not only with respect to the application of accounting principles, but also with respect to the application of the auditing standards. I don't think we always agree, even within the firm, as to what constitutes sufficient, competent audit evidence. So I think it's important that we look at all of that in context. If you want to look at another factor that may impact audit quality, we ought to look at the reporting deadlines. Several years ago, the SEC accelerated the reporting deadlines. 60 days is not a lot of time to get an audit done with respect to some of the judgments and the estimates that need to be made. We talk about, fair value. Well, if an audit firm were required, if had 6 months to do an audit, they could go out and do an independent calculation of fair value, get all the inputs, do the calculation independently. We do not have 6 months to do that. And the capital markets will not tolerate that. So the context of what constitutes sufficient and competent audit evidence should take that into consideration. So I just think it's important that we keep this in perspective as we look at addressing, audit standards as a motivator, because I think there's plenty of motivation right now.
Thank you, Jim, for those comments. Now, Doug Anderson.
Thinking a little bit about culture, as an internal auditor, of course, like any auditor, independence and objectivity is really critical. I think one of the differences in internal and external auditors is objectivity has a different context for an internal auditor, because any internal auditor has got to recognize that if you do your job right and really act with objectivity, you clearly could put your career at risk with that employer. And I don't think any chief auditor or audit executive would take the job without recognizing that they could clearly lose their job with that employer by doing the right thing if they maintain their objectivity. So as I think about that role as an internal auditor, or the concern of objectivity, the concern isn't so much that somebody just goes off reservation, one of my staff just purposely makes a wrong decision. The real risk is that you get seduced into losing your perspective, and you get seduced into losing your objectivity and make a bad call and accept something you shouldn't. And I've always felt that the largest protection against that is culture. Making sure the firm and the organization's got the right culture to really prevent somebody from being seduced in that way to losing their objectivity, and just continually reinforcing the culture. So as I think about how to do that in a public accounting firm, I was in one of those firms a long time ago, so I'm sure things have changed. But there are ways to assess it, to assess culture and monitor culture closely to make sure that you don't have the ingredients that could cause people to make bad decisions. We do that as an issuer to comply with 404 and 302 and SOX. We have to assess the culture in our organizations and the tone in our organizations to be able to make the assertion that we have adequate internal controls over financial reporting. We do that through surveys. We do that through looking at individual pieces, connecting a lot of the dots, constantly driving to root cause analysis on issues we see to explicitly and formally assess the culture in our organization. And so I would think that there would be an opportunity, maybe the firms already do it, but to make sure that at a firm level, at an office level, at a partner level, there's an explicit consideration of culture and tone that's being set, and measure that and watch it and monitor that is probably the best way to prevent loss of objectivity by the individuals.
Okay. Thanks, Doug. Arnold Childer.
Thank you. I wanted strongly to support what Marty said about the tone at the top. I think it's a very important point. We have seen that recognized more and more over the years. And when the IAASB discussed a couple of years ago its standard on quality control, after serious debate, this was actually the first requirement in ISQC 1, starting about the leadership responsibilities for quality within the firm. And the first line there is, the firm shall establish policies and procedures designed to promote an internal culture, recognizing that quality is essential, etc. Before coming to the other elements of quality that are fairly similar to what is in your paper. So I was quite pleased, Marty, that you brought the point up, and I hope that it will come back, because that's all where it starts. And it then continues the important role of the chief executive or the managing board, etc. So I think that's a very powerful starting point.
Thank you, Arnold. Lynn Turner.
I'd like to come back and respond to something that Jim said about the audit partners doing the right thing. I used to have the view that people in the firms do the right thing, but then we ran across a whole raft of these with Enron and WorldCom, Adelphia, Quest, Tyco. Every one of the firms, Xerox, every one of the firms had a rash of these. And the notion that litigation and the risk of litigation, which are real, I think they're very real and very significant, would deter someone from succumbing to the pressures, if you will, of the job and rationalizing away a bad answer, I think went by the wayside. And I just don't buy the notion anymore that reputation alone, after living through that and certainly what we went through in the last couple of years as well, that reputation alone is the most important thing for people even in this great profession. And I think the quality controls are important, and I think people these days will and have done the right wrong thing unless there's some mechanism for making sure that what's happening is transparent and that there's a high degree of accountability when people do the wrong thing or behave in a bad way. So, and I think that certainly applies to this profession as well as to other professions. One of the things is this profession has an extremely important role. It's probably one of the most difficult jobs you could have, but it's also one of the most important because if this profession doesn't get its job done right, our capital markets can't function and tens of millions of people can suffer. And that's very important. So I think the board taking up this quality control project is great. I think you got to think out of the box on it. And I think you also have to think very globally on it and in light of where we are today with the world's overall economy, not only today, but where it's going to go. The international stuff is going to become much more important as more of our business does go offshore. And as the U.S. shrinks as a percentage of the international global market, the stuff offshore is going to become more important. And how do you maintain those quality controls in light of that? So I do commend the board and the staff for moving forward. But the notion that reputation alone will keep people doing the right thing, I think that's a misnomer and a figment of someone's imagination these days.
Steve Rafferty.
Thank you. I didn't realize until Lynn started there that I was going to agree with him on something, but I am. I think you're on the right track here. I commend the effort to address the quality control system because you are finding things in the inspection process, and I think you have to step back from those findings and say, am I finding these over and over again? Are they indications of systemic problems in the system of quality control that we need to do something about? So I think you're definitely on the right track, but I think we have to be realistic that we can write standards, but standards have to be written at such a high level that I would be willing to bet you that you could write any quality control standard that you want, and sitting here today, all of the big firms would meet that standard. You have to drill into the details to determine what those controls and procedures really need to be in any firm. Just like when we go through our inspection process internally in our firm, we carefully evaluate the results and have to step back and ask ourselves, is this a one-off problem or is this an indication of something in the system that needs to be fixed? And I think the PCAOB has a real opportunity here in the remediation role that you play in the inspection process to drive some development of internal controls and procedures within the firms to truly improve audit quality and address some of these things that you keep seeing over and over again, whether that's a consultation process that's missing or a review process that needs to be revised or whatever it is within a system. I think you've got an opportunity to address that kind of thing. So I would encourage you to do that, to evaluate those root causes and see what the remediation might ought to be, but in many cases it will be a firm-on-firm decision. I think setting some higher threshold than we have today will perhaps work well for some of the smallest firms, but certainly not the biggest. And then finally, I think, you know, with respect to the whole culture thing, I think my own observation is the better my controls, the more I drive integrity and culture and communicate integrity and culture within a firm. So I would encourage you to take advantage of the opportunity to drive culture by requiring controls and procedures be improved.
Barbara Roper.
I wanted to agree with what Doug Anderson said earlier. I had the experience recently of listening to Dalian Kane, who's a professor at Yale in the School of Management. He's a behavioral economist, and he was talking about some of the insights behavioral economics and offers into actual response in various industries and with investors to conflicts of interest, among other things. And his basic point on conflicts was that no matter how concerned you are about the harm that conflicts cause, they're worse than you realize. And then the other side of that, which isn't as directly relevant here, is no matter how ineffective you think disclosures are in addressing those conflicts, they're less effective than you think they are. And one of his points was that people have a way of getting comfortable in their own mind with what they do, and that people don't think they're doing the wrong thing a lot of the time when they do the wrong thing. And so, you know, and I was also going to make the point that Lynn already made, which is that the PCAOB exists because the threat of litigation and concerns about reputation and all of those things that we've traditionally tried to rely on didn't work to prevent a number of people getting comfortable with audits that simply weren't reliable. So I think there's a role for quality control standards as part of the solution to that, and enforcement as part of the solution, and whatever. On the culture issue, there's an example from the broker-dealer experience. I'm showing my age here, in that it's a report from the early 90s when Leavitt was chairman of the SEC, and they did something they called the Large Firm Report, where they went in. There was a reporter at the Los Angeles Times who had done a series of articles about the major brokerage firms hiring brokers with long records of sales abuse practices, and they were managing to stay in the business despite all of these rules that were supposed to be in place at firms for supervision and whatnot. And so they went in and they did this series of special enforcement examinations at the 9 largest firms. And they found a number of sales abuse practices within what were supposed to be the, you know, the leading firms. But beyond that, they found something in excess of 80% of the violations were at one firm. Now, that is a firm with a deep-seated cultural problem that isn't going to be addressed through standards. And if, you know, exists in the, in, and they ultimately ended up, if I, they, the SEC didn't name the firm, but if I'm right about what the firm was, and I'm like 99% certain that I am, they ended up paying the largest settlement ever in the history of the broker-dealer industry at that time for some of the sales abuses that they were engaged in. So I do think you can't ignore this question of the role that culture plays in setting the conduct within a firm, and try to get at that through whatever means you can.
Denny Beresford.
I'd like to say just a couple of words about culture also, especially for the very largest firms, 150,000 or whatever people around the world. I think this is a very difficult thing to make sure that everybody's getting the same message. And just to share a very recent experience I had, I participated in an academic listserv of about 700 people. Someone circulated a video that they'd found on a website, and it was one of the major firms was announcing a new program, and they'd sent a video around all their people around the world, I guess it was, about 5 minutes or so, celebrating again a very exciting new program, and had people quoted from all over the world about this, and they went on and on about how exciting this was, and they were talking about their relationships with their clients, and it was all of the value we're going to be adding to our clients based on this new program, value added, and then a couple of references to the client doesn't really care how we get to the answer. It's the final answer that they get that's really most important to them. And I really didn't react to it very well, and I just, to this listserv, I sent a note back and said, this sort of sounds like kind of back to pre-Sarbanes-Oxley, and there the firms go again a little bit. And I just had finished in my class talking about the Anderson situation. And again, I just shared that with this listserv. A couple days later, I got a call from one of the partners from that particular accounting firm saying that he was calling on behalf of the worldwide and America's CEO of that firm, saying that they were very concerned about my concerns. First of all, they said that they were concerned about my blog. I said, well, I don't have a blog, first of all. I just had shared this with this listserv. And they wanted me to know that their concern was, or that their issue was obviously quality at all measures. That was absolutely what they want to do. And I said, I know that, absolutely. I know that that's what you want to do, and that's the message you want to get across. All I'm telling you is that you sent this message out to 150,000 people or whatever it was, and what I heard, what I'm thinking of as a SAP accountant or a manager or whatever getting this thing was add value to all your clients. The client wants to get the final answer. They don't really care how much you got there, how you got there, and that doesn't sort of strike me as quality as our most important thing. He said, well, that's not what we intended, and I thought that was the end. First of all, I thought they were going to put a hit on me after sending the thing out. And then a couple of days later, I got a call from one of the two CEOs himself, reiterating that they were very concerned, and I just wanted to be sure that I had gotten the message right and wanted to inform you again. So, but again, I said, I'm not trying to start any trouble here. I'm just telling you that I think this is a very serious issue when you're trying to talk about a very important new program for the firm, but what message are your people getting? Now, maybe the 160,000 people didn't get the same message that I got, and they weren't, probably all of them weren't studying the Arthur Andersen situation at the same time that they were getting the message. So they probably weren't kind of sensitized in the same way that I was. But I think that's a real challenge that the firms have, is trying to get people to work together on these things. And I just think that as the firms, frankly, the larger firms in particular, start moving back into more and more of the consulting type practice, start broadening their practices again, I'm not saying there they go again, but I think there is at least a little bit of a concern in the professional community that we are perhaps taking our eye off the ball just a little bit. We're looking to the PCAOB to make sure that that doesn't happen, and to the firms. I, as a former partner in public accounting, Jim, I still count on the firms to help pay my retirement too. So I worry about these things. But I just think that we all have to be very sensitized to these things and worry about the messages that we're sending to all the people in the field.
Jim Snur.
First of all, I don't want to leave this group with the impression that I don't support quality control systems. I absolutely think that they're essential. And to Denny's point, the bigger the organization, the more important they are and the more robust they need to be. Secondly, in terms of looking at the culture of the firm, tone at the top, I also agree with that point. I think ISQC1 is very focused on that, including looking at the responsibility of senior management for the quality control systems. I do think that one area, Marty, I think you brought it up earlier, you know, in terms of, you know, where does the quality control system report in the organization where you don't have kind of an independent board of directors is probably a good area to look at. And I would note that a number of the UK firms have started to take or bring independent directors onto their boards, and I assume that's one of the reasons they've done it. So that could be, you know, a very fruitful area to look at. So thanks.
Mary Morris.
Thanks, Greg. And Jim, I'm glad you brought that up, because that's what I was going to talk about. First of all, thank you from the investor's perspective. I think, Doug, you mentioned that, you know, ideally quality control is supposed to help investors and the confidence that it builds.
And I think that many of the comments were very important as far as transparency. So I think one of the things that I just want to make sure and maybe bring it up again to the audit firms is, in the UK, they are looking at audit firm governance. And what is, I think, one of the things that we all think about is, and we talk about incentive pay and compensation. So what are the drivers? What do audit firms believe that's success? And what are their key performance indicators? And so for us, for investors, it might be nice to get some kind of, what is that audit firm governance? What is that code? And I think that many of the firms have said that, yes, they're going to start doing that across the board internationally. So I think that might be helpful. And I would like for, you consider that, maybe an audit firm governance code.
Thank you, Mary. In the few minutes we have left, we do have some more questions that we may have some more comments on. The first couple of questions, some of these I've heard comments on several of these as we've gone through the discussion this afternoon. The first one, could an integrated framework similar to the COSO framework, would that better emphasize the need to design and implement a system of quality control that appropriately develops all necessary elements, integrates those elements of quality control into a complete system, and stresses an ongoing assessment and remediation of deficiencies? In addition, would a separate risk assessment process to identify, assess, and address relevant risks to audit quality improve the design and implementation of systems of quality control? If you think about those, and also we had additional questions. What changes to the board's quality control standards would better motivate firms to use known audit deficiencies to identify and remediate defects in quality controls that allow the deficiencies to actually occur? And are there lessons learned from other industries that could be useful in designing and implementing systems of quality control for accounting firms, for example, the recent reforms instituted for the credit rating agencies? So with those questions in mind, any other additional comments, remarks? Doug Anderson?
I just want to make a quick comment on number two and the risk assessment process. I would think a QA process, just like just about any other process, risk assessment is not a separate process, but it's fully integrated, understanding it. Throughout the design and the execution and evaluation and monitoring of a QA process, you have to consider the risk of the various pieces. So clearly, risk has to be there. I took exception to the word separate. I don't think it's a separate process. It's risk assessment has to be integrated throughout the QA process.
Thank you, Doug. Paul Sobel?
In response to number one, first of all, I always like pictures, and even though I know it was a fairly cryptic drawing, I did like the kind of modified COSO cube that you had on the previous page. The comment I had, which actually supports a little bit what Doug says, is that to me, and you can tell by the discussion that we've just had over the last hour, to me the key is making sure there's sufficient guidance on that control environment slice of the cube or whatever framework you end up using. An awful lot was developed for companies subject to the Sarbanes-Oxley Act. Sometimes you get into 100-plus questions, which I think was overkill. But I do think it might be helpful to come up with some guidance or maybe even specific questions or criteria to be considered at the control environment level of a big accounting firm.
Well, thanks, Paul. That's very helpful.
I think that was the point of utilizing the COSO cube and framework here, the point you're making, and actually, Doug, the point you made as well, that to some degree, one could look at the quality control standards as a listing of procedures, things to do. Firms may have integrated them, and maybe they're not in the way which the firms are applying them. But we did think that potentially a framework similar to the COSO environment, where it was all put together and all of the pieces worked together, starting with the top one, control environment, culture, tone at the top, then leading all the rest of them into an ongoing risk assessment throughout, as well as performing all the other quality control steps that were there before, might have some benefits in how one looks at quality controls if it was more of a framework approach. So as we're thinking about things to explore, as someone said, out of the box, I'm not sure if the COSO framework is out of the box completely, but applying that type of framework, which is used very well in industry as they evaluated their controls and the design of their controls, potentially as a framework for firms to look at for evaluating their quality controls and the design of the quality controls, might have some effective, might be effective.
Lynn Turner.
With respect to question one and the COSO notion, one thing that seems to be missing in COSO and certainly was missed during the financial crisis was the ability of a quality control system to pick up and react to changes, changes that are going on in the economy or elsewhere. And so if you go that path, I think you got to build something into this quality control system that says, is it actually searching for changes that may be impacting this, and if so, is it reacting and adjusting to that? So that's on number one. On number four, again, I would think out of the box here, and I would certainly look at the compliance programs inside the 40 Act, the investment complexes. They have some very significant issues with respect to compliance and controls. I think some things that the SEC did in the first half of this last decade there, including with respect to establishment of a compliance officer, the reporting format, and what that compliance officer has to do to ensure that the inspection program is working, is very good and certainly worthwhile. And I happen to know that's what the Dodd-Frank bill was modeled after when they did the credit rating stuff, and I think the credit rating stuff in the Dodd-Frank bill is very good as well, including, to Mary's point, the fact that it looks for this compliance officer to be independent and reporting up through some accountable governance-type mechanism as well, and building all of that in is good. The other thing I'd do is I'd reach out to a couple of firms like McKinsey and Boston Consulting Group, who consult all the time on quality, certainly in the context of the ISO 9000 type stuff. And I think it'd be very helpful to get their perspective on quality and what makes for good quality systems. And I'd certainly, I'm sure they'd be willing to spend some time with you. So I'd reach out to them because they do an excellent job in that area.
Thanks, Lynn. I appreciate those comments as we move forward with our concept release. Bob Dacey.
Thanks. I just wanted to bring up the fact that in our government auditing standards, otherwise known as the Yellow Book, we do have a requirement for audit organizations to at least annually analyze and summarize all of the deficiencies they've noted in terms of their monitoring processes, identify systemic issues that are causing them, and develop recommendations to address them on a broad scale rather than on individual audits. So if you want to talk at any time, we'd be happy to share our experiences in that regard. Thanks.
Thanks, Bob. We'll plan on that. And Danny Beresford?
In thinking about both the last issue we discussed and this one, it kept coming back to me that if we had some sort of a framework for documenting audit judgments, that it would have addressed at least some of the issues that we face on these topics. So it seems to me that that might be something you should be thinking about. If nothing else, I was struck by, I think it was Walt's comment about the horizontal approach to looking at some of these issues. I know that several of the accounting firms have developed their own approach to documenting judgments about accounting estimates, for example, right now. I think it would be helpful to capture that kind of information and perhaps have some sort of a best practices type of a pronouncement included in either as a separate item or in some other broader list later on.
Thank you, Denny. And Neri Buxman?
A couple points. I think when we think about designing a system for quality, I think first you need to step back and say, what is quality? So somebody needs to define what's a quality audit, what are the levers that are looking at audit, and then the second issue that I'm a large proponent of since I started dealing with quality in my own organization is the notion of measurement. Regardless of tone at the top that we all believe does exist, I think if you do have, and even if you put the PCAOB organization totally aside, The larger the organization, the greater difficulty to understand how the tone reaches every corner of the organization. So there's a notion of constant measurement, defining those levers, and getting some information and some data. And when you think about data in the context of the accounting world, you can think about two types of data, or data buckets, if you will. One could be process indicators, number of hours, number of training hours, that type of talent that you have for a particular audit, the number of findings, or so number of audit changes, and so forth. And then you have a product quality, you know, how many of our products actually failed. And I think some of those indicators, going back to our earlier discussion, should not be always looked in isolation. There's some element to look at all these data elements, and I do agree that at some point it's important to understand who within an organization look at those data points, who considers them, and who takes action with respect to the indicators that are being observed by the organization itself. So I do agree that an integrated framework is quite useful and important, but I think regardless of the framework, what it is, the challenge is that currently is how do you deal with quality and what's quality? Some would say, I recognize quality when I see it. It's quite interesting because we're all speaking from a voice of experience, but without having a framework to define what quality is, and also go to some questions that were inherently asked when this board was first established is, can we actually not looking at quality as meeting similarly exceeding a particular yardstick and then where quality stops? Is can you actually discern or differentiate among audits in some spirits of quality, or you are trying to differentiate between an audit that is just okay and an audit is a quality audit, even though both have not resulted necessarily in restatement? So this could provide you an opportunity to actually penetrate this area that has been, many investors have been asked to get some more information, and actually some of the discussion associated with more information in the dialogue with auditors and audit committee speaks directly to that.
Thank you, Neri. And a few remaining questions. If there's some additional comments, we've already touched on the cultures in the firms. Last two questions, what changes to the board's quality control standards might be necessary in light of the potential changes to designing and implementing a system of quality control? Are there other challenges that should be considered? And the last one, what attributes are necessary for a firm culture to be conducive to audit quality? What requirements or other measure could the PCAOB propose to motivate firms to promote a firm culture that minimizes incentives that do not promote audit quality? We've touched on audit quality. I know we had several very good comments or remarks on the firm quality throughout this discussion, but I wanted to see if there's any other tent cards, any other discussion or remarks in this particular area. And then we had one last question. What quality controls should be in place when using the work of a foreign affiliated firm? We haven't spent a lot of time in that area. We have, I know, in other previous SAG discussions when we talked about Appendix K as well as the adoption of IFRS. Any additional comments in this area?
The only comment I'll make, Greg, is that the existing QC standards are don't say a lot in this area. There's QC 20.06, I think it's basically that one sentence or so that indicates that a firm should have controls in place to ensure that the work of its affiliates comply with professional standards. And I think the essence of this question is this is an area we have to explore for many reasons as part of this project, and an area where the initial belief is that quality controls to be in place when using the work of affiliated firms probably needs significant attention. Gary Gaber.
I'm sorry.
Greg, to your question, it's really, I guess, question five about the quality control standards. And maybe this is already buried someplace in there. I'm just prepared. I'm not all that familiar with them, but under QC section 40 about competencies expected by the engagement partner, one wonders, should you have a standard or a quality control procedure or whatever about this, the firm's policies with respect to admitting partners? I mean, it seems to me it starts there. I mean, it's the partners that are there are fine, but it's the partners of the future is what's going to sort of carry the firm's legacy going forward. And what are they looking for in admitting partners? I mean, I appreciate revenue generation is certainly a part of it, but there's a lot of other pieces as well. So again, maybe it's already in there, and if it is, I'll retract or drop the statement, but it's just a suggestion about what you might want to consider to look for.
Hopefully it's more than revenue generation.
And they said many other things, hopefully technical competence and having a backbone and stuff like that are more important.
Any other comments, remarks before we conclude for the day? Okay, I'll turn it back over to Marty.
Well, Walt and Greg and Brian, thanks for leading that discussion. I think the involvement of everybody around the table was clearly indicative of the fact that the SAG views quality controls to be very important and views identification of needs or areas and ways to improve quality controls as being very important. So I think we've got a lot of very good messages from all of you in terms of things we should be focusing on in this project and taking that forward. So I appreciate, again, a very lively discussion and input on what's to us one of our more important projects going forward. Well, thank you all for a very being with us today and being very, very involved and engaged in all of the discussion items that we had. These meetings are only good to the extent that you're very engaged and add a lot of comments, and you certainly did that today, and we appreciate that very much. I think we're ready to wrap up for the day. We have a reception right across the street at the Madison beginning at 6:30, and look forward to seeing you all there and then back here again tomorrow morning at 8:30 for the session, but continental breakfast beginning at 8 a.m. Thanks a lot, and we'll see you at the reception shortly.
If those sitting around the table would like to leave any of their materials here at the table, they will be here tomorrow morning when you return. So you don't have to take all your packets with you if you don't want to.